So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review it.
Right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
Is he going to set him up? He's going to hate those wings. And here it goes. AJ fights it all. Now he gets it back.
Name of the show. I'm John Pollock with Wei Ting. What are you giving me that look
That's
for?
A very interesting introduction. You've never done that one.
I don't like to be so repetitive.
Review Away is the name of the show.
I don't even know why we do an intro. Like in a world of podcasting, you're not scrolling through the radio dial. You know what you're downloading. You know what the show is. You know who the hosts are, and you know what we're talking about. So why do we have to preface it by saying, "Hey, you downloaded what you downloaded"?
I'll say though, sometimes I just like kind of let podcasts play if I'm like doing a long tedious chore, and then one podcast will play after another without me actually clicking on anything. So I might be listening to, you know, Review and Impact. The last episode of Review and Impact, by the way. And then all of a sudden this will come on. I'm like, what? What is this show? What is the name of this show? I need somebody to tell me the name of the show.
Well, that's good for people like you that just let podcasts just run.
Yeah, I'm sure I'm not the only person.
You know what I started listening to? This new podcast called Limetown, which... there's only two episodes of it out. One came out in July, and then the second episode just came out a few weeks ago. And it's a fictional story about this town in the U.S. that recruited all these different scientists to convene in this one part of the U.S. And then all of a sudden, in February of 2004, the city of 300 or so, everyone disappeared. So this female reporter...
Is this a true story?
No, it's fictional.
Okay.
You would have heard if a city just disappeared and all the people in it just vanished into thin air. So this woman is a reporter, and she actually had an uncle who went disappearing. And now she's going back and she's trying to find out what happened. And it's so well produced.
So it's like Serial? It's like one of those?
Yeah, it's like Serial, but way more, way heavier production and...
What are we talking about here? Like a radio drama?
Yes.
Okay, so we're back to those days now.
I think they're really good. Well, this one at least, I think is... I've only heard the first episode, but I was like listening to it in my room, and it was all dark, and then it was right at the end, and my wife opened the door. Dude, I jumped. It was really scary.
I wish I could see the scene.
She's like, what's wrong? I'm like, I'm listening to a podcast. She's like, what the hell are you listening to?
Why?
Like,
so you're listening to this show in the dark?
Yeah.
Like,
I want the full effect. That's what I do, Wei.
You should actually go out to the forest in a deserted
town. I could. If I was like driving home late at night listening to this?
Yeah.
Oh my God, dude. I'd be so scared.
That's very interesting. I'd love to see that scene.
I get scared very easily.
Next time you listen to the show in that setting, please send us a photo.
What do you get?
Tweet out a photo.
Okay, I will. I don't like the lag, though. The first episode, let me pull this up. I only found this because it's like one of the top podcasts out there.
Limetown. Okay.
The first episode was July 29th. The second episode, which I haven't listened to yet, September 13th, which I understand. These episodes are a lot of production goes into them. Yeah. So I understand that. It's a seven-part series. So it's probably going to last close to a year.
That's ridiculous, though. That's like 2 months.
Well, I mean, if this is your main gig, I mean, what's the turnaround time? Like, people put TV. Look what South Park does.
Okay, but I would still rather you, at least build a bit of a buffer and have a bunch of these pre-produced before you start rolling them out like that. That's too long to wait.
It's too long. I don't mind not being weekly. Weekly is sometimes too much.
Yeah. Comic books are.
Except for us.
Comic books kind of have that issue, too. Like, first run comic books, mm-hmm. There's this Marvel's big event right now. It's their new version of the Secret Wars, which is a big. I don't need to get into that. You look bored already.
No, Secret Wars.
Secret Wars, yes, is their big summer crossover event. They do one every year where they kind of put all the superheroes together, and this one though just happens to be incredibly delayed. So, I mean, they're on a schedule of doing one issue per month, which is sort of standard. Even that's a long time to wait, in my
opinion. Sounds like the Chinese democracy of comic books.
Not quite that bad.
No.
But anyway, so you know, with comic books, they basically write them and they produce them often as they get released. So you'll get issue one in the stands before the rest of the series is even finished. So with this one, I mean, they started, I think, back in like April or May, and it's not scheduled to conclude now until like November or something like that. So we're talking, you know, like a 9-issue series that's going to span that much time. And it's, I think, today you're competing with so much other forms of entertainment that it's hard to keep people's attention for that amount of time.
In comic books, I mean, how far ahead are they planning out stories? I mean, are they way ahead and just writing backwards? Or is it somewhat like wrestling where you're just – sometimes it's just issue to issue that you're changing stuff?
I mean, I think it probably largely depends on, you know, the publisher, maybe the writer, maybe the politics involved. There are definitely a lot of politics involved too. But I think for the most part, a writer gets assigned to a book and he has sort of a long-term vision of what that book kind of wants to lead towards.
Mm-hmm.
So, and in comic books, of course, you have more control over, you know, long-term booking, if we want to call it that, because
imagine writing a comic book where the characters all had a say.
Might take off
and
mid-run.
They could. I mean, think about it. Think how crazy that is that wrestling deals with, where these characters that are fictionalized have creative control, or they're just going to – or a character could get injured.
Exactly.
Super. And there's no end. Yeah. It just keeps going. It's a fucking wheel.
Comic books really don't have much of an end. I mean, you know, Superman, Batman have been around for decades. But yeah, what if actually Batman was like – he did break his back. You know, in the 90s.
I would love to read a comic book by Vince Russo where he breaks
the fourth wall.
Color fave, whatever the fuck you call it.
Color fave?
Yeah, where he's got to explain issue 25. Bro, we sat down with Ultraman to go over the finish, and Ultraman was playing politics.
Ultraman.
And okay. it's all the behind the scenes of these characters that really do exist.
It actually would
And show up at fucking DC.
Stuff that has actually been done like that. I mean, Deadpool is a character that often breaks the fourth
like
wall.
A comic book that's fictionalized, but you deal with the as if it were a real world. It would be horrendous to comic book fans.
It's,
but I think a train wreck from the outside that I would love.
No, I'm pretty sure stuff like that has been done, you know, in the past. And it's not always bad. It's not always, you know, terrible. For some reason, I think when talking about WCW, it ended up being really bad. But I feel like those topics can, like doing meta fiction can actually be very interesting and very cool.
I'm very excited this week because I've got my old computer back, if you haven't noticed.
I have noticed.
My cord came in the mail from Las Vegas that I had left in a hotel room after 2 weeks, and I got the package, and inside the package, there were a set of keys, and suddenly I remembered that Braden had left his house keys in the hotel as well, and I had not asked about them.
Oh, my God.
But they just assumed they were my keys, and they tossed them in the package.
Wow.
So Braden owes me huge.
Did Braden not even realize?
No, he knew he left his keys there. He was just going to replace them.
Wow.
And so when I put in my lost and found thing, I just mentioned my cord. I didn't even think about its keys.
You guys really fucked up.
Well, he left his keys. I left my laptop cord.
Well, he fucked up more than you did.
So then today I get to work, my first day bringing my new computer back to work. And what did I forget at home?
The power.
My power cord. I had to walk home.
Do you remember your keys, though?
I do have my keys. Okay. I never forget my keys anywhere, thankfully.
Someday we won't need any of that stuff.
I hope not.
You won't need a power adapter. You don't
seriously. Like, just give me...
You'll be fingerprinting.
I'll probably be able to, like, solar power from my eyes or something. Like, that
sure.
would be all the energy it needs.
Yeah. Or maybe you can breathe. Like, the power of your breath could power a computer.
Yeah, we'll all be toxic.
Yeah.
That'll be a couple years away.
Yeah.
You know what is... today's sponsor is on Review Away.
Tell me.
It's a new coffee I like to call the Ting.
Yeah.
Milk, sugar, and a shot of espresso whey.
And?
I haven't taken a sip yet.
We'll try it out.
So you're going to see by the end of the show what effect this espresso has on me.
Yeah. I don't know if I think I read it on a message board or something. But
ooh, it's so sweet.
Is it?
But good. Not overly sweet.
Do you usually put sugar in your coffee?
Yeah. I usually get one sugar and one milk. That's okay. It. And this, I added the espresso shot.
Yeah. I don't know if the espresso should add any sweetness, but anyway,
it tastes a bit sweeter.
It just, like, to me, it gives a bit more of a coffee flavor and kind of, you know.
How did you stumble upon this? Was this just an experiment on your part?
No, as I was saying,
you've been drinking them of late, and that's what urged me to try.
As I was saying,
oh,
I might have just found it online. And somebody was just saying how, you know, like Tim Hortons is. People talk shit about the coffee at Tim Hortons. I don't care. I think it tastes fine. But somebody recommended, you know, what a lot of people are not aware of is that you can add espresso shots.
You need a shot of something right now.
Yeah.
You're starving.
I'm not.
No.
Anyway. Yeah. What was I saying?
Is this effective for you? Do you get a jolt from it?
Definitely is. Yeah, I didn't have one today, though. I just had a regular coffee today. But, I mean, I'm still a bit of a lightweight when it comes to, you know, caffeine. So caffeine still pretty much does it for me.
Well, I'm excited to see what this does for me.
I don't know if you would notice a difference, though, because you're regular coffee.
This is my second coffee of the day.
Wow. Okay.
Wow. That was a concern.
But you notice any difference?
Not a whole lot, to be honest.
Yeah.
I drink coffee because I genuinely like coffee.
Do you notice a difference when you don't drink coffee?
Yes, but I think it's all mental. I don't think there's necessarily coffee flips a switch for you.
If I buy you a coffee every day and then one
I will
day,
never turn it down.
One day I gave you a decaf. Do you think you would?
Oh, I can taste the difference. And decaf is very much, you can taste the difference.
No, oh, okay.
It's pretty noticeable, I find. At least at Tim Hortons. But decaf is fine. I don't think I would feel any different if I started drinking decaf in the morning.
Right.
I don't think I would have much different reaction to it. As strange as that may be. Are you excited to chat TNA Unbreakable?
Yes. Yes, I am.
Turns out they were breakable. Maybe not. At the time we are doing this,
they're not dead yet.
They're going in the Bound for Glory, and Unbreakable is maybe a great term for this company, who are the masters of the 11th hour Hail Mary.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not looking great for TNA.
I think we said that like a year ago.
Hey, people were saying that in 2002.
Mm-hmm.
People were saying that in 2000, every year after 2007.
Mm-hmm.
And here they are. They're technically on television. Do you feel that they're going to be somewhere come 6 months from now?
6 months from now, we're talking like March?
Yes.
To
rewind,
yeah,
Dixie Carter has said they're they are looking, they will need a new U.S. partner come 2016, indicating that the Destination America deal ends at the end of this year. Mm-hmm. What they're going to fill during this time, that's a big question mark. Mm-hmm. And then said later in the article in Sports Illustrated, the writer noted that they would be going somewhere in February, or February is some kind of target, I guess. February 1st, we'll throw out. So that's where things stand right now. Lots of questions. No one knows what's going on. Next week's Impact is going to be curious to see what is filled on there, whether they have enough stuff from the last set of tapings to fill 2 hours. And beyond that, I don't know what's going to go into these Impacts. They are supposed to go on a tour of India at the end of November, so they could theoretically be taping television then. So anyway, back to my question. That's kind of the facts that we do know.
Mm-hmm. I think they will be around. I think the brand still has some name value. Maybe not so much amongst, you know, the hardcores or even the mainstream pro wrestling fan base here, but I feel like they still have a lot of international deals that are... I mean, for instance, the Fight Network, I think TNA does very well on our channel.
And they are very happy with the numbers that TNA does.
And so, you know, even if it comes to a point where they have to tape shows in India, I'm sure they'll find a way to at least fulfill those obligations and maybe still somehow make it somewhat manageable to run this business, but on a much smaller scale.
This show was very fun to go back and watch for myself. Mm-hmm. This is probably the most popular match in TNA history. I don't think that's a stretch to say.
It's the number one match on many people's best TNA matches list.
It was so big that a number of years ago, they had this trading card deal.
Yes.
And
I bought a pack, actually.
You bought a pack?
Didn't I buy a pack for you when I went to...
Oh, yeah, when you went to Orlando. You bought me a pack of Impact cards.
In New York.
In New York. Yeah. Okay. So when they were putting these cards together, they had the individual wrestlers, and then they had TNA moments.
Yes.
And TNA contacted me and asked if I would write the back of the card for this main event.
Really?
They asked me, pick a match in TNA history that you would like to write a quick blurb about on the back. And I replied, I said, sure, if you'll credit me, I'll write about the Unbreakable main event. That was the match I wrote about. And they sent me this gigantic poster of all the cards that were like laminated.
Like an uncut sheet?
Yes, uncut sheet.
That's cool.
I mean, like double the size of this big screen in front of us.
Wow, okay.
So it's in my parents' basement somewhere.
Why don't you put that thing up in here?
Do you know how hard that thing is to transport?
Yeah, I suppose.
I mean, it was a pain in the ass, this giant thing that arrived at my office at the time. And yeah, there was my card, whatever number.
What did you write?
I don't remember. I wish I was actually there over the weekend, I should have taken a picture of it.
If anybody has this card, I mean,
I said something to the effect that these three for years had proven they could steal the show, and this particular pay-per-view gave them the confirmation they could headline the show.
How cool would it be if somebody had this card and got you to sign this card? I mean, as a kid, I don't know if you ever collected autographed baseball cards.
No,
but
I didn't.
I certainly did.
Autographed?
Oh, yeah.
Where would you get autographs?
At, like, card shows.
Oh, you go and meet athletes and players?
Yeah, I went to the first time, actually, it was some Junior Jays thing at the Skydome.
I remember those. I got the Junior Jays magazine.
Oh, me too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought they were cool.
They were awful. They were god awful.
Come on, you were what, 8 at the time?
Terrible.
Did you really have standards?
They're terrible comics with like...
Oh, man, you're a dick.
The Junior Jays.
Well, who did you meet?
I met Ed Sprague.
Ed Sprague?
Yeah.
Ed Sprague threw a ball to me once. I caught a ball from Ed Sprague.
Wow, shit.
Yeah, third baseman.
Who knew? It's like...
Transplanted catcher.
And a transplanted hairline as well.
That's right. He was... his hairline was about 50. Well, he was half that age. Who else did
and,
you
meet?
Ed Sprague.
Ed Sprague, I got his autograph. A big deal was the day Devon White showed up at Woodside Square.
Whoa.
Yeah.
The center fielder.
Yeah. And
number 25?
I got my Fleer Ultra signed by Ed Sprague. That was a big moment.
Devon White, I mean...
Devo.
Very clutch player. I mean,
we should. Are we sure you want to talk about?
Yes,
baseball?
Absolutely.
We've been criticized for talking.
I don't
about
give two
sports.
Shits. We'll talk about anything.
You've been criticized by somebody on your
I mean, multiple Golden Gloves. And then he had that year in 93 where he was one of the top hitters in the, that year mm-hmm. was insane. The 92 was a very good team put together, especially at the deadline when they added David Cone. But 93, holy Christ, that team. Devon White, Roberto Alomar, that was John Olerud's big year. You had, of course, Joe Carter was in there.
Paul Molitor. They finished 1-2-3
in I remember
the batting
that.
Average.
That's great. I mean, this year alone, I mean, you have Josh Donaldson that's hit over 40 home runs. Jose Bautista, he's probably going to hit 40 with the amount of games they have left. He's probably hit 40 by the time people are hearing this. Anyway. let's continue. I think if the Jays make it to the World Series, we're going to do a review of a game instead of an event.
I don't know about that.
That's how I want to respond.
All right.
I've watched so much baseball this past 2 months.
Yeah.
If the Jays do make it to like the World Series or something, mm-hmm. and there's a meaningful game on a Sunday or Monday, I'm really going to be annoyed.
Yeah, of course.
And there will be.
Oh, yeah.
There's no way I'm going to be able. And a Saturday, Sunday, Monday, those are the busiest nights when it comes to shows.
I think I'll let you take the day off if you really wanted to watch the game. I could fill in for you.
I gave up Leafs tickets for you and me.
I know you did. John won a pair of Leafs tickets, but the tickets happened to be on a Monday.
A Monday night. Platinum seats.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
That's dedication.
They were tough to give up.
It's dedication. Raw or Leafs tickets?
I wasn't going to leave you hanging.
Appreciate that.
But the funny part is, if that Monday turns out to be like, that could be the World Series, like a deciding game. Ooh. I do not believe the Blue Jays are winning the World Series. This team's very good.
Nobody ever thinks that their team is going to win the World Series. I don't think so. Simply just, I mean, to me, it's, I don't know.
I don't even think they're making the World Series.
Well, maybe it's just like growing up in Toronto, but you can't help but think that it's too much of a fluke. No way. The chances are too slim.
I do not trust this bullpen.
Yeah.
I think they're, man, all right, they make things scary. Yeah.
TNA.
I don't even know how we got onto base. People you met. Devon White at Woodside, whatever.
Woodside Square.
So you met Devon White?
Yep.
Any other notable? My favorite was Kelly Gruber. He was my favorite player.
He just disappeared after 92.
Well, yeah, he had that. He was supposedly injured, and then someone got a photo of him jet skiing, and it got into all the papers.
So that was I feel like we talked about this on this podcast.
And then he got sent to California, and Ed Sprague emerged in the 92 World Series, and Gruber was gone, and Ed Sprague became their new everyday third baseman.
Right, cool.
But Kelly Gruber was my favorite growing up. I went out as him for Halloween 1 year. It would have been in 92.
What does the Kelly Gruber look? What was it? What are the signatures?
He actually looked like a dirtbag. like the shitty mullet.
Yeah. And that's what you had?
No, I didn't have a mullet. I just wore a Kelly Gruber jersey. I had a Blue Jays jersey, but it didn't have any name or number. I don't think I had a name or number on the back, so I used like white electric tape to spell out Gruber and 17.
That's adorable.
I had to make it all by myself.
That's very cute.
And then I didn't really have a favorite player after Kelly Gruber left. Mm. Just like, there's a lot of good players, but everyone loved Roberto Alomar. I was like, I'm not going to be just another Roberto Alomar lover.
Mm. You're not
he turned out to be. Yeah. Hey, guy's spitting on umpire's face. I mean, I'm not going to sing the guy's praise. Great fucking player. Maybe the best player in Jays history, but a bit of a dick, too.
Anyway.
So, that was it.
Okay.
You want to wrap this up?
Yeah.
Great three-way.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Okay. Sunday, September the 11th of 2005 was unbreakable.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, was this worth the dollar for you? Was that that was a big question.
I'll say so.
I think this is a great service that they have. A buck for a three-hour show?
Yeah.
No commitment.
Mm-hmm.
I like it.
I like it.
We always say this whenever we review a TNA event. Usually we have to just buy it on their YouTube thing. And it's very low cost. It's no commitment. But they never mention it. You would never, never believe that the library is accessible like that on YouTube. And I don't even know what kind of a cut how much of that dollar they even see. And believe me, it is probably a minuscule amount of people buying old TNA shows.
Yeah.
But no one knows about it.
Not to mention that this was a rather tough show to find, to even buy.
I mean, I had to ask you. Just send me a link.
Just to even, like, typically we just go to Google video search and try to type this stuff in, but or even on YouTube and looking for it. And typing that in, you're able to find the main event for free, absolutely. But to find the full show, it actually takes a bit of navigation. And I think part of that is because TNA has multiple services that they can, that they're trying to charge for. One of them is like sort of a, their version of the network, I suppose, where you pay, like, I don't know if it's $10 a month or something like that. You pay a certain monthly fee.
Very low investment. But you got to really work to find it. So if
That's
you can
right.
find the dollar show at the yeah. end, you do pay in other ways. That's
yeah,
what you're saying.
Absolutely.
In a roundabout way.
So anyway, we found it. But actually, John, let me just stop this conversation right now. Something just fell on my desk. You'll never believe what I found.
Oh, no. What?
Look at this.
Oh, my God. Where did you find these?
They're Neil's. He just met Kelly Gruber this weekend.
What?
I'm holding...
These are two autographed Kelly Gruber baseball cards.
I just...
Both of which these cards I have, not signed.
I swear I just, like, walked out of this place.
That
like,
is nuts.
In an instant. And then I was just, like, looking around. And I was like, there's a guy who works around here. His name's Neil. I saw on his desk... It's two autographed Blue Jays cards, and they're Kelly Gruber cards. What are the chances? We were just talking about that.
That's amazing.
So anyway, you can't keep those. Do you think that I was going to give that to you?
Yeah, no, I should keep at least one of them,
no,
right?
No.
Wow, look at this. I'm just looking at the team here from that.
You have both those cards.
I'm pretty sure I have both of these. I used to collect baseball cards like a maniac.
Why don't you hold them up? We'll put them on the Instagram.
Yeah, absolutely. Kelly Gruber. Would you agree with his... It's hard to see the hair, especially on these are like earlier ones of his.
Would I agree with the scumbag look?
I wouldn't even say scumbag,
like scumbag,
but just looks he's kind of all over the place. He looks actually very
that.
Composed in that photo. The other one is not really a good depiction.
Okay, I got to bring these back.
Oh yeah, he probably has you under a microscope to give those back. Well, that's insane. Two autographed Kelly Gruber cards, and that was not a plan either. We just naturally started talking about that, and then Wei ran out of here and ran into our pal Neil, who has these two cards of Kelly Gruber's that are signed. I wonder what a Kelly Gruber autograph goes for in 2015. I would imagine it's not too steep an investment to make. Kelly Gruber autograph. I'm just asking how much a Kelly Gruber autograph might be worth these days. You can go to sportsmemorabilia.com.
Dude, how much are trading cards worth at all these days?
Kelly Gruber signed photograph 8x10, $24.99.
Oh, my God.
These signed baseball... It looks like $28 is the going rate for a signed Kelly Gruber card. Look at all this. These are like the exact cards, too, that you just showed me. $22.
Hey, why don't you type in Devon White? Let me see how much my Devon White. I'm guessing $5.
No, that man. I think Devon White was a bigger deal than Kelly Gruber
the baseball
was.
Baseball cards themselves are just not worth anything.
Okay, dude. Devon White, that's a photo. That 27, that's for an Angels card.
I probably paid $20 to even get that autograph.
These are about the same, $23, $24.
All right, well, you should finally get to this match.
This Marlins one, though, 8x10. The photos. That's what you want to get signed. Photos, not cards. Photos go for more.
I suppose.
Okay, TNA Unbreakable. We found the show. Collectively, we spent $2 on this particular event.
Mm-hmm. But if you don't want to even do that, if you're so cheap, you just
Some
can't
are.
Even part with a dollar. The main event is available for free, uploaded by TNA themselves.
Well, that's dumb.
Well, I mean, you can clearly see that they don't. They're not really banking.
I bet they're making nothing off YouTube.
Yeah,
so I guess why not just put it up. But I don't. If the main event's for free, no one's buying this for bloody Cassidy Riley and Jarrell Clark.
Except people who are revealing the entire show.
Which are two of us. So there you go.
You get the pre-show though.
I bet you someone at TNA got a fax and we just got 40 cents of royalties.
Yeah.
From Unbreakable.
Mm-hmm.
So from their usual location of the Impact Zone in Orlando. 800 people, gate of zero, which was an issue with them at the time. But, man, watching this show, I don't know. This was just weeks before they were going to debut on Spike TV. and I couldn't help way but watch this show. And to me, it was, it took me back to watching Impact at this time, where a lot of the 2005 period, it's certainly romanticized as the great time TNA was in the marketplace. And it really was. It was a their pay-per-views were fantastic throughout that time period and into 2006. But I saw a lot of the same qualities that 10 years later we associate with NXT, but presenting something very different and going with untapped talent that had not been major national stars, having a different idea. And it just felt like this was a company with a lot of momentum growing, and here they were on the cusp of their biggest leap onto a huge cable outlet with Spike TV. It was a great time in TNA history in 2005, even if they weren't a giant profitable venture at this point in time. You saw the makings of something that truly was an alternative in 2005.
Right, yes. And this was also the same time that they were about to... The Fight Network was about to launch, and...
Yeah, just a few weeks after this.
These guys were about to come up, actually, for the Fight Network launch party.
Yes.
I remember that very vividly, where...
it was Bound for Glory weekend. They were up here.
Yes, right before that, where we actually... The Fight Network actually just put on this, in hindsight, completely ridiculous launch party.
Hindsight?
Yeah.
I think you and I were talking about it that night.
That's probably true. But just, I mean, they spared no expense. And these were...
they ended Joe's losing streak.
No. No, Joe actually lost here. He didn't get pinned.
Well, he lost again in a four-way or something at our party.
He didn't get pinned, though.
Was he pinned?
Was it elimination? I don't remember. Whatever. It doesn't matter. But anyway, the previous owners, the founders of the company, they... I mean, if not for them, we wouldn't have jobs, obviously. But this party, though, was a little too extravagant. We not only had TNA matches, we had a
championship boxing match with Steve Molitor,
Chuck Liddell, Bret Hart. Everybody was there.
And Meltzer was at the party.
Meltzer was there. Yes, that's right.
Carl DeMarco.
But the TNA aspect of it, they actually held a match between Samoa Joe, Rhino, and Sabu.
That was the match.
Yeah, and we also had Petey Williams versus Chris Sabin.
Yes.
So, yeah, got to see those matches live.
Didn't you and Samoa Joe recently chat about that night?
No, we didn't.
Yeah, you did.
We didn't chat about it. No, I don't think I even brought it up.
Weren't you talking with him about... Didn't someone, the PR team, come from TNA for that particular show?
What are you talking about?
Okay. I'll jog your memory. I could have sworn it was you, though.
PR team.
A PR person that was let go shortly thereafter.
Oh! Yeah, you're right. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we'll leave that story for another day. The show opened up, which Way thought was the pay-per-view, with Jeremy Borash.
Yeah, these versions on YouTube, they actually put the pre-shows on.
Yeah,
so
you don't have the countdown clock. So
I started watching this thinking that, oh, man, a 3.5-hour show. So anyway...
Jeremy Borash opens it up by putting over the Orlando crowd as the hottest and wildest in the world, and he's co-hosting the pre-show with Shane Douglas, stating that no one does pay-per-view like TNA does.
We also had a video package to start off the show with the deep-voiced TNA guy, which he hasn't been used in a long time.
James Earl Jones has not been lending his voice to TNA for quite some time.
Well, this guy's name is actually Barry Scott. But yes,
Barry Scott.
Very much like James Earl Jones. But I thought, you know, these openings I thought were always really well done and very reminiscent of like a WWE late 90s style. And that's obviously because of the work of David Sahadi, who was a producer at TNA at the time.
Yeah, one of the key creative people that came over to TNA at this time. Tracy Brooks was a backstage interviewer at this particular time. She interviewed Larry Zbysko, who kind of had the figurehead role. And we cut to them as they're in the middle of an off-camera conversation to make it look natural.
No way. This definitely had to be a screw-up. It definitely had to be. It made no sense. These two, they basically cut to Tracy and Larry seemingly early.
I totally felt that they were just trying to make it seem like off the cuff.
Why?
Just to make it feel alive.
No,
I don't know. You're right. I didn't see any point to it.
It just looked like that these two were chatting off camera and they forgot to get a cue.
Tracy was very awkward in this role.
Kind of, yeah. It honestly came across like, you know, they didn't really have anything else for her to do, so they put her in this interviewer role.
Larry Zbysko, who's the babyface authority in TNA, states, "There was a time when men were men and women were glad of it." And somehow this segued into him approving Raven's request for a Raven's Rules match with Rhino for the NWA title later on the show. So Zbysko not only adding a stipulation, but also putting women in their place.
Well, he, not only that, but he...
As Tracy had to... Thanks! Back to you guys.
As this interview ends, you could see Larry directly swing his gaze from the camera right to Tracy's cleavage. Like he didn't even try to hide it. As the camera, as he's finished talking, his eyes just zip right to Tracy's boobs. And it was hilarious.
Tracy's
he couldn't even wait. He couldn't even wait till they were off the air. He just had to, like, dart right over.
The announcers for the show are Mike Tenay and Don West. And they state how TNA is going to attempt to continue their streak of hot Sunday night 3-hour pay-per-views. This pre-show completely did its job for me of getting me excited for this show. Mm-hmm. And God, the energy of Don West and Mike Tenay. Some people ragged on Mike Tenay towards the last few years in TNA. But going back to 2005 when he was so invigorated with this product. I mean, these two I thought were very good. Don West to me was always... It's the same kind of reason I enjoy Vampiro in Lucha Underground, where, yeah, he's not your nuts and bolts great broadcaster, but he's so energetic and a fan of the product that it comes through the screen. And you have a great play-by-play guy to overcompensate for the things that the color guy lacks, but he brings that energy level, and that's what Don West always had.
Yeah, I think of comparing him to a lot of commentary duos of recent years. I definitely think they're very good, but I mean, I've said it before when reviewing TNA shows. I almost felt like their energy was too high at times and unwarranted at times. You know, where they're certainly very high energy duo, but then you have matches like. As an example,
the diamonds in the rough,
Kip James and whoever, like, that just didn't warrant that level of energy, but they would still be calling it at a 10. And to me, that's when it kind of seemed insincere, the energy. But, you know, overall, I thought they were fun.
They had a few quick matches on the pre-show, Cassidy Riley and Jarrell Clark, Mr. 630 for the, 630 splash he would do off the top. And Riley is doing a Raven's follower character at the time, just dressing like Raven.
Dressing like old school Raven with like the cutoff shirt and the cutoff jeans.
There were a series of Japanese arm drags by Riley. And then Monty Brown comes down, just walks into the ring, and hits Clark with a lariat. And the DQ is called at a minute 54. And thanks a lot, guys.
Yeah.
That was it. It was a backdrop for Monty Brown to cut a promo on Larry Zbysko and TNA. Riley is standing in the ring and tells him to fuck off, but Monty does not leave, attacks Riley, and hits the pounce, and then continues his promo, demands a title match, and the crowd starts chanting, "What?" And he responds, "I'm telling you what, idiot!" And they continue to chant, "What?"
So he's a heel.
He's kind of a heel, but the crowd was certainly getting into him. He was very charismatic, especially at this point in time. That wouldn't transfer over to WWE, but this was certainly... He was a great character that they had crafted. Not the most talented guy in the ring. And made a challenge for the winner of Raven and Rhino for Bound for Glory. Jeff Jarrett comes out in his ring gear, despite not having a match scheduled for the show. And he asks Monty if his brain is all scrambled from his football days. I guess Jeff Jarrett, looking into the future about all the concussion issues that they would face, says more unemployed wrestlers are backstage than the whole TNA roster. Everyone wants jobs now that TNA is exploding, which was kind of true at the time, and takes credit for all of Monty Brown's success. Then Kip James comes out, a man who had quite the role on this show. He was all over this particular Unbreakable event. Jarrett was kind of stumbling in his promo, promises to have possession of the NWA title by October 1st when they debut on Spike. Then Jeff Hardy comes out next. This was turning into the opening Raw monologue. One thing you have to say about Jeff Hardy, the guy has gone through a lot in 10 years, man has not aged.
Yeah, true.
Really incredible. Mm-hmm. He has not lived a soft 10 years, so to mm-hmm. speak, mm-hmm. and comes out. This was not Jeff Hardy, I think, in his element. 2005, I mean, he felt like a wreck on television. He had missed shows. Yeah. He was just, to me, he was a bit of a shell of what he once was at this particular time and wouldn't get reinvigorated until he went back to the WWE.
Mm. It almost came across, even in a short segment like this, just in the way he kind of carried himself as he walked to the ring. He almost like, he walks out with just like a very loose and incredibly like kind of weirdly, awkwardly carefree attitude that's not really, you know, not necessarily suitable for somebody who's about to go out and compete. Like it just felt more like he was coming out to a rave or something.
To his Per Oxygen theme song.
Oh, God. Yeah, this is another Jeff Hardy theme song.
I'm surprised you never got into his music.
Yeah, anyway.
Per Oxygen with a question mark somewhere in there to substitute for a letter.
Yeah.
So, Jeff Hardy comes out, fought with Jarrett, some chairs were involved. We saw Dixie Carter at ringside. Irate. At Jeff Jarrett, to become legitimate years later. And then Hardy blocks the stroke onto the chair and DDTs Jarrett onto the chair. And then we see a video for the NWA title match. Rhino won the title shot, but then he wouldn't give the title shot over to Jeff Jarrett. And Raven calls himself a human cancer. Then Borash and Douglas run through the card inside of the ring. Tracy is then with a very young AJ Styles in the back. He notes his past battles with Christopher Daniels and Samoa Joe, says he stood above the rest when TNA launched in 2002 and is the face of new age professional wrestling, and he will continue to be that face as they move on over to Spike. Interesting that throughout this show, they made frequent references to Slammin' Saturday Night, which they were going to be calling that block on Saturday night and moving up.
What else was supposed to be on that, in that block?
Well, that was it at this point, because Ultimate Fighter was moving over to Thursday nights at this particular time mm-hmm. with season 2 of the Ultimate Fighter.
Was it some other UFC programming? Like
they were just calling the theme Slammin' Saturday Night to describe. I think they would air
Unleashed
like the UFC
something.
Countdown shows or Unleashed yeah. on Saturday nights. Anyway, but they never on this show, to my recollection, said the name Spike TV at any point. It was always just moving and almost being coy about where they were moving, and I didn't understand what that rationale was. But anyway, he referenced it. Now that was all. Tracy and AJ.
Yep.
The beginning stages of AJ's promos, I guess we can say. And then Mikey Batts took on Shark Boy. Batts would sign a developmental deal with the WWE about a month after this. So this was his springboard. And Batts was dressed like in his his Nova developmental gear. There was an enziguri to Shark Boy. Shark Boy bit his ass. There was a pescado to Batts on the floor. Batts shoved the referee into the rope, stopping Shark Boy on the top, playing possum, and then he caught Batts with the Dead Sea Drop and pinned him in 327. Very short match.
I stopped watching the pre-show at this point.
Oh, you didn't even stick through it.
The moment I realized, oh my God.
This is the pre-show.
I just spent 20 minutes on this thing. I decided to just...
I took a whole page of notes on this pre-show. I think there was too much going on this pre-show, to be honest. And then Borash and West were in the crowd for the hard sell. And then it abruptly just cuts off to this graphic citing the American spirit. Because, of course, this was happening on the anniversary of 9/11 and Hurricane Katrina had just happened as well. Mm-hmm. The opening video of the pay-per-view was a spoof of the NFL films with the voiceover and previewing the show. This was also the opening weekend for the NFL season. I thought this was a terrifically written script, very clever with all the footage they used, comparing it to football. There was this great pounce call. I thought this was a great video to open up the show. I enjoyed it a lot.
It was cool.
Very creative.
It was cool. It was something different and something relevant to the time. I'll say a lot of the references probably got lost on me because, I mean, I'm a Canadian. Maybe if it was a bunch of Blue Jays terms,
yes.
I would have got it more.
Yes. The sponsor for this pay-per-view was a CD entitled All Jacked Up by Gretchen Wilson.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I was trying to figure out what that was.
All Jacked Up.
This is at a time when TNA sold advertising on the ringside apron.
Yes, they had this and Morphoplex, which was their big sponsor at the time. They were actually at one point going to try and buy a portion of the company.
What is Morphoplex?
It was some vitamins, like, that they had Larry Zbysko pushing and, you know.
Yeah, it's just weird. Gretchen...
Wilson.
I mean, somehow this name of this person, whoever she is, will live on, continues to live on 10 years after the fact that her album came out because of this great match. Anytime you think about this great match, you're going to see Gretchen Wilson.
All jacked up. We should play some Gretchen Wilson to end the show.
If you can find it.
By the way, we may be joined later on in...
By Gretchen Wilson?
No, we're not going to be joined by Gretchen Wilson, but here we are. Is that the real time we're at?
Yeah.
Jesus
Christ. We bullshitted a lot.
Oh, my God. 45 minutes in. We are going to be joined by Nate Milton later on in the show.
Oh, my God.
Big reunion. And we may or may not have an interview from somebody involved with TNA the night of that show from The Law.
God damn.
Because this was during a time when The Law and TNA, we had a great thing going where the TNA PR department, they would give us someone every single pay-per-view night after the pay-per-view, which I always thought was really cool of them because it's after the pay-per-view. They're not really pushing it.
I remember the night Kurt Angle was announced on that pay-per-view.
And we had Samoa Joe on.
Samoa Joe was...
He was going nuts.
He was like... It was like he was in a hotel room or something, just going crazy, excited at the news and talking about how everybody wanted to see him versus Angle. Yeah, I remember that very, very well.
The first time we had Samoa Joe on the show, we had him on and we're doing the interview. It's Dan, Jay, and me. And then we went to a commercial and we're like, can you just hang around for another segment? And he said, sure. So during the commercial break... Mouth gets on the phone and he's just like, hey, thanks a lot. He's like, it's a real honor to be talking to Dan Lavransky.
Mm.
So Samoa Joe is always great, as you would find out years later, Way.
Awesome.
Yes.
Yeah, great.
So anyway, the show begins. We're all jacked up for this event. And we start off with the Diamonds in the Rough. Simon Diamond and his proteges, I guess. The gimmick was underutilized wrestlers on the roster. Elix Skipper, who I would say had a much bigger national run than Simon Diamond did, and David Young, who did not, taking on three live crew, Conan, BG James, and Ron Killings.
That's right.
And
we got another R-Truth original theme song.
That's right. He came out. They had been teasing Dissension for a while here, and they kind of squashed it in the ring as Conan apologized on the microphone to BG for not trusting him. And
because at this time, Kip James, of course, came back, Billy Gunn.
And was a heel.
And they were suspecting Road Dogg of joining Billy Gunn.
Yes. So they put aside their problems.
I have to say, like, I mean, the whole concept of the Three Live Crew, of course, is three people who are very much into hip-hop culture. And...
Don't you dare stereotype one member.
I'm not, but I'm just saying, I know Road Dogg has basically made a career off of, like, you know, being a rap guy. The rap thing just does not age well for him. I mean, especially here. 1998, maybe, okay, but even in 2005, seeing Road Dogg come out here trying to, like, you know, I don't know what he's doing, shucking and jiving, you know, trying to
be
do that
jizzle.
Rap. It was embarrassing to watch.
Wow.
Yeah, man. It was, man.
I mean, Three Live Crew, they were undercard. This was their perfect role. Opening match, get the crowd ready. We're not going to do a whole lot. Like, this was probably the worst match on the show, excluding the pre-show, which you can't really grade. They were so short. Truth and BG James did this spot where they double-teamed David Young and, like, did this dance and then knocked their feet together. It was like the Lisa Turtle screech dance when Lisa broke her ankle for the Casey Kasem dance-off.
Don't recall that.
Anyway, I don't know if that's what they were channeling here. Young then slapped Skipper as an... Diamond slapped Skipper as an example of tough love.
And Tanae describes him as a coach with the fiery attitude of Bobby Knight.
Yeah, there's a personality you want to be replicating. As they get the advantage on BG, Conan comes in. Skipper does his Matrix bend, if you want to call it. And then Conan just stands there and then delivers an inverted DDT. Like, Skipper does all this work and Conan just flattens him. Mm-hmm. Takes off the shoe, which was Conan's gimmick at the time. Rolls into a clothesline to Young and then whips the shoe at Young and then hits him with the K Factor for the win at 4 minutes and 21 seconds.
The K Factor.
The K Factor.
On a show that was supposed to feature Sean Waltman.
Well, yeah, there's enough letters in the alphabet to go around.
Okay.
K, X.
The W Factor.
You know what could have been a great reformation had Waltman been around longer? You bring the K Factor together with the X Factor. They could have reunited and made a whole new X Factor.
What?
I just wanted to play the music, that's all.
I got it. Okay. Not much of a match, you know, especially...
The crowd did get into Three Live Crew. This was nothing special.
Hold on
a
second, though. Hold on a second, though. This was the Impact Zone crowd. They got into everything. Okay?
Well, you know what? So many people have said over the years that they had to get out of the Impact Zone. You can't perform in front of the same fans every week. They're not paying. It's park tourists and stuff. And I go back to this time. This crowd helped these shows.
Yeah.
They did not hinder them when you had a hot product.
I think you're right. I think in the end, it really was.
I think that's such a crutch that they used at the Impact Zone for what was a shitty product at the time that got away from what the audience like. This was the same tourist that didn't pay anything that saw Impact every other week.
But at the same time, like, as somebody who's trying to watch these matches to see what effect they had on the crowd, I wouldn't necessarily take this Impact Zone crowd as a barometer for how great the matches were. You know, how great the viewer would have perceived the match, because it felt very inflated at times.
But this was how the audience reacted. I mean, that's what you have to go by. They got into it. This is the crowd you're playing to.
I know, but you're also talking about a time when TNA was hiring women, these girls, to be in the crowd. These same three girls. Remember them?
Yes.
The same three girls that would be in the Impact Zone crowd just to cheer and applaud.
But
come on.
I mean, they weren't hiring 800 people.
I suppose not. But I'm just saying, I remember watching these shows at the time and thinking that, you know, didn't feel real.
The Impact crowd would be very nauseating at times, but I don't read it all as like it was this gigantic negative that it was made.
No, it wasn't.
My bigger issue was that you were running at a place where you couldn't make any money off your audience. And that was just the situation you had at Universal Studios. You couldn't work around that. But nonetheless, we move on to the showcase match involving two members at the time of Generation Next in Ring of Honor and identified as such as coming from Ring of Honor, mm-hmm. Austin Aries and Roderick Strong.
The Aries was supposedly voted in by some
They did a fan poll at the August pay-per-view that they did. So TNA fans had seen him. And I like that they weren't so shut off to not acknowledge Ring of Honor. It became very territorial months later, where they would not allow TNA talent to work for Ring of Honor any longer, as TNA was growing and needed more dates and didn't want them on DVDs for Ring of Honor. But at this point, they had a pretty good relationship, and TNA and Ring of Honor weren't these adversarial forces. They were viewed much closer together rather than radically different promotions mm-hmm. in 2005. So it was an initiative to bring in independent talent, and Don West brings up their connection to one another, Roderick Strong even wearing Generation Next trunks to the ring. Aries does the Tiger Mask spot, popping out of the legs into a drop kick to Strong. Strong blocked a monkey flip and then caught him with a backbreaker and runs into the opposite buckle. He works over the back of Aries. Hard Irish whip into the corner, applies a full Nelson with his legs, and then there's these big chops hit to Aries. Aries comes back with a pair of clotheslines, the pendulum elbow drop, and then Aries runs, snaps his neck on the top, and hits the twisting slingshot splash onto Strong for a two count. Roderick hits the Death by Roderick, which is has him on his shoulders into the double knees, and then a sick kick for a near fall. Aries blocks a half Nelson suplex and hits a running drop kick and brainbuster, and then follows with a 450 splash and pins Roderick in 8 minutes.
I thought this match was so good. I mean, I thought it was a tremendous surprise on the show. I didn't think I'd even see these two this match on the show, but this was a really fun to see, because you have two guys here who are just so good And I think at this point, so hungry for that national attention that they didn't necessarily get wrestling in Ring of Honor. So they got here on this big stage, and it was just great to see their style of wrestling that's been, to me, like so high level for such a long time, get the same treatment in the presentation with these professional cameras, professional lighting, professional production that they don't get in ROH. And this crowd, I mean, this was a reaction that I actually believed in from the crowd. And you compare this match to the match that came before. In terms of in-ring, there's just simply no comparison.
And they nailed the color balance on all three cameras.
Yes, they did.
So this was a great add-on to a pay-per-view, I feel. And this was at a time in 2005 where guys like Austin Aries were not anywhere on the radar of WWE. Mm-hmm. They had the U.S. to themselves in that sense that, yes, Ring of Honor was promoting this style, but TNA, they had their pick of the litter when it came to independent talent, and they could fuel their roster for years to come if they had subscribed to this method. And
oh, man. Yeah.
A lot can be said about their... It became this interpretation that, oh, these are great workers, but they're not stars. We have to add these elaborate characters.
Well, yeah, who
and
actually...
It watered down a lot of
these
guys.
Did they both get signed coming out of this?
Aries, they came in for a while, and then Roderick Strong would eventually cease working with them, and Austin Aries would come in and then got repackaged as Austin Starr. Mm-hmm. So to me, it's a perfect example of just putting this character on a guy that I don't care how much the guy is invested in the character. It was just, to me, it was...
The gimmick certainly didn't help things, but...
I can't think of one gimmick that helped some of these X-Division wrestlers.
It was more so, I think, the booking of him at the time. And, you know, he was pretty much just categorized as a cruiserweight from the start, you know, being put in those skits with Nash and all that. It wasn't until he made his second comeback where he was actually being treated like a serious dude.
Shane Douglas is with Monty Brown and Kip James in the back, and Kip is pissed about Monty Brown going after Jeff Jarrett on the pre-show and tells him to go apologize to Jeff. Brown says he doesn't apologize and tells him to keep his head in the game when he's questioned by Kip. And all I've got to say about Monty's promos, man, this guy popped his peas like nobody's business. The pounce and period.
What I loved about this segment was throughout all of this, you could hear the crowd in the background still chant, "That was awesome," at the Aries and Strong match throughout this entire thing.
You don't think they were referring to Monty's promo on the pre-show?
I don't think so. I mean, it's another one of those instances where I wish that they kept the camera a little longer at the end of the previous matches.
Of everything on this show. They had such a bad habit of... This was just clearly their philosophy that a match ends, boom, cut. You never allowed anything to breathe, even the main event. We went off the air like 30 seconds after the fall.
Yeah.
And I hate that. Yeah. Take some time to register what you've just processed.
Exactly. The calm. It's the cigarette after, you know, the climax.
That's it. Perfect. Yes. Perfect analogy, Way. So then we went to Kip James and Monty Brown against Apollo and Lance Hoyt, who were accompanied by Sonny Siaki in a neck brace.
You know what Kip James and Monty Brown called their team? Or should have called their team?
The Full Monty? No.
James Brown.
That's great. What would, you know what they'd call Lance Hoyt and Apollo?
No.
Holo.
Okay.
Kip came out to this horrible instrumental version of his Ass Man theme.
It was a WCW ripoff, essentially, of the Ass Man theme, which I'm amazed that they even attempted to do. It was the Ass Man theme without the lyrics, which were kind of what made the theme.
So low rent and something they never should have. This became a trend for them.
Well,
and
the guy came here and he couldn't use the Mr. Ass gimmick. You know, he couldn't even use Billy Gunn. Instead, he was Kip James, which is. Of all the names you could choose, Kip James?
It was one of the problems with the Spike era where they believed, well, we need all these people that... I remember at the time, everyone would throw out the term Q rating. What's his Q rating? How many people are aware of our performers when we do these surveys? And they'd fall in love with like just these names that had been on WWF television.
Kip
Kip James. Yeah. His Q rating is just going to be through to the roof. His Kip rating. Cute Kip. Remember that? He became Cute Kip at one point. And to me, it was bringing in these guys that were marginal performers in the WWE. And Billy Gunn had his run. He had certainly his years.
Mm-hmm.
But then bringing him in just for that reason. I mean, there was a reason for some guys, but when it became littered with them, it got away from you guys having your belief system of what we're producing will click at a certain level. And I feel if you had stuck to this product and invested in it on Spike TV, the rewards you would have reaped 2 years down the road, I think that'll be an always a what-if question that will never be answered. Anyway, we go back to James Brown in action. Monty tagged himself in and is arguing with Kip. This allows Apollo and Hoyt to get the advantage. It was very confusing here because Monty was opposing Jeff Jarrett on the pre-show and then playing heel with Kip here in this tag match. And he was someone that was certainly getting over with the audience because of his promo ability. I don't think the audience really knew how to react to Monty Brown. He was positioned as a heel but was being received as a babyface at this point. We saw Monty Brown hit a running rear view to Hoyt in the corner, and then this wacky-looking side slam that he delivered to Hoyt. There was a double clothesline with Hoyt and Kip. We went through a bunch here. Big boot to Kip, and then Hoyt hit a moonsault off the top. Brown came back, tosses Kip away, and pounces Apollo and steals the pinfall in 10 minutes, and then Kip and Brown are arguing on their way to the back, so... The simmering intensity here between Monty and Kip was just building.
The finish was odd to me because who was legal?
I didn't think Monty was legal here. He just came back into the ring without tagging in, and I think the announcers were also very confused by this.
Mm. I actually thought all in all the match was pretty good and exceeded my expectations. I mean, I think it could have probably benefited from maybe being 3 to 5 minutes shorter, but I thought Apollo and Brown... both look very good. Kip, at this point, obviously the oldest of the group, but I thought he was working hard to keep up. And you had Lance Hoyt here, who, you know, was very noticeably green, but also to me seemed to get the best reaction out of the four from this crowd, who were just seemed to love this guy's look and, you know, were chanting his name a lot.
You know what was also green? These extremely tiny trunks that Kip was wearing at the age of 41.
Sort of his gimmick.
The time. Like, his ass was kind of part of the gimmick.
Couldn't he have been Mr. Butt?
He was the butt of a few jokes, I'm sure, at this time. Lance Hoyt, though, really took the cake, though, with his white and black pleather ensemble with dyed blonde hair.
He was definitely a test.
And a tramp stamp on top of it.
Oh, man.
He had that ugly tramp stamp. Unfortunately, that's a decision you just can't take back.
Yeah, you can't.
Gray Maynard and Lance Hoyt.
That's when you should decide to maybe put on the shirt, I guess.
It's not a day that goes by where you don't look at that and be like, fuck.
I'm trying not to look at it.
Yeah, well, it's in the right spot, I guess. Then we went backstage, and Tracy was with Team Canada. Bobby Roode, Petey Williams, Eric Young, and Steak Sauce.
A1.
A1. Yeah. And... Eric Young is playing the moron role at this point in time. Roode tells A1 to step up and earn his keep. And Roode calls Hardy a half-baked nutjob. And he's next on his list to be Canadianized. Petey then cuts a promo on Chris Sabin being trained at the same school and having the same coach, but he has the better finisher, which would be true, and says Sabin is an inferior American.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to see these future TNA main eventers play basically mid-card comedy acts on this show. I thought Roode here, for instance, you know, you could see really how much he had progressed, you know, comparing to now in terms of promo ability. I thought he sounded fine here, but he'd go on to become way better and way more confident.
So Petey Williams took on Chris Sabin. They explained that Petey is a sub for Shocker, and Mike Tenay just puts AAA on blast here because they changed his booking at the last minute to make it logistically impossible for Shocker to make it to the impact zone. So don't blame us, blame AAA.
Oh, okay.
Sabin has the early advantage. Williams blocked a sunset flip powerbomb to the floor, and Sabin then missed him off the apron and went into the barricade. Williams then has him in the Tree of Woe, standing on his balls as he sings "O Canada." And then Sabin landed a kick, and Williams countered a powerbomb into a DDT in midair. Sabin hits this flurry of forearms. He's selling the ribs. They trade chops, cradle suplex by Sabin for a two count. Williams teases the Canadian Destroyer, but Sabin rolls through, and then Petey applies the sharpshooter, gets to the rope for the break. They continue. These two, I mean, have worked together so many times that their chemistry is very evident. He gets run into the turnbuckle from his shoulders. And then Williams, while he's on the shoulders, rakes the eyes of Sabin, sends the referee into Sabin, and almost gets hit by the cradle shock as he's blinded, and then catches Williams, hits the cradle shock after blocking another Canadian Destroyer attempt, and it's Chris Sabin that pins Petey at 12 minutes and 35 seconds.
I thought Williams just... Everything he did looked so smooth, so great. Sabin did too, but I think Petey was just that much better. To me, this match, I can't help but compare to, you know, the Strong Aries match that we just saw, because it you know, two-letter guys with great chemistry, having worked together for a long, long time. This match didn't impress me as much as that one, but I thought it was still very good, and I think just showed how full of talent this roster was at the time.
Before Sabin has any chance to be ignored and they sent to the back, Matt Bentley ran in and super kicked Sabin and then got onto the microphone. Bentley had not been on television for a number of weeks and had been having some contract issues, and acknowledged this, stating that everyone thought he was bound for up north, but instead he is bound for glory and wants to have an ultimate X match.
Kickboxing?
Yes, a future Spike property. And then super kicks Williams, and that would set up the Ultimate X match for the following month at Bound for Glory.
Was there much truth to that rumor? Matt Bentley going to...
I mean, there had been a lot of discussion because his contract, I believe it had ended with TNA. And, of course, he did have the affiliation with Shawn Michaels, of course, that he was certainly someone at least on the WWE's radar. Mm-hmm. But I think a much better, at least at this time in 2005, they're about to go on Spike. Bentley was going to have a much better opportunity in TNA than WWE, even if the money might have been different, I'm sure. They aired a video for Abyss and Sabu featuring a Jim Mitchell promo throughout and threatening to have Abyss cripple everyone until he gets his NWA title shot. And this was always a great thing that TNA did at this point in time, was even if guys weren't directly involved in the title picture, they would always mention the NWA title as their ultimate goal. You had everyone chasing this title, even if they got detoured with other feuds. That was always the end goal that they had spread out throughout many of the main guys.
Everyone in the scene, yes, in the main event scene. But it seemed like they had a very clear distinction between, you know, people in the main event and the cruiserweights in the X division.
Abyss and Sabu were next. And we went to a close-up of a fan who had a sign that just read, "Abyss sucks." And they constantly would cut away to this sign, I guess, just to emphasize to everyone
how much he sucks,
that this guy sucks. And Mitchell is in this light orange suit and cuts a promo wanting this to be a no disqualification match, and then the lights flicker and Sabu appears, which I guess was Larry Zbyszko's acknowledgement that he'll allow the men to be women, the men to be men and the women to be glad of it, and approve this stipulation match. So all you had to do was just say you wanted something in a match and boom, it was done. Matt Bentley got it, Abyss, Raven.
Have you ever tried that in the office? Just go out in the middle, turn off the lights, put the lights back on, and say, "I want a raise."
Done.
Have you ever tried that?
Done. We need Larry Zbyszko to maybe be our coordinator here.
Yeah.
Our union rep.
Well, if he wants it that much, then yes.
These two had a very different match than anything else on the show. It was a hardcore match, which sometimes they can be feast or famine. And in this particular case, I mean, I've seen plenty of Sabu matches that are very sloppy, all over the place. This was not one of them.
No.
Sabu was, if you enjoy hardcore style matches, this was pretty damn great for that, because Sabu hit everything. And there were some ambitious spots throughout this match with these two. And Abyss hit this belly to belly. And these fans are passing the chairs through the crowd to deliver to Sabu, who hits an Arabian facebuster with the chair, then springs off the chair and clotheslines Abyss to the floor. Sabu brought a table out with one of the legs breaking, so Abyss would cover and get a fresh table out, and Sabu hit a somersault dive from the ring to Abyss on the floor, and then drop kicks the knee of Abyss as they return to the ring. Sabu then springs off the top, hits this tornado DDT flawlessly, sets up Abyss in the ropes and runs at him, and ends up taking a belly-to-belly over the top, and he somehow lands in between these two tables that are set up on the floor. I mean, there was such a tiny area, and that's where he landed. Looked painful. The fans are chanting for thumbtacks. There's a table set up in the ring, and Sabu hit him with chair shots, whips it at Abyss's face. Then Sabu comes off the top with a chair and leg drops Abyss through the table using the chair. Mitchell then places his leg on the bottom rope to break up the count. Abyss attacks from behind as Mitchell gets on the apron, hits the shock treatment, and Abyss kicks out. Then Abyss goes under the ring, pulls out the thumbtacks, which, of course, gets a huge reaction from the crowd that had been chanting for this. And this was kind of the trap that Abyss fell in, where it suddenly became the expectation that this guy would always use tacks, and then later it became glass, and it just, you became numb to Abyss using all of these weapons. Anyway, the tacks are spread out all over the mat. Sabu blocks a chokeslam, blocks a powerbomb, then attacks Abyss with a chair. He goes for the triple jump off of the ropes and goes for the DDT in midair, but it gets countered with the black hole slam with Sabu landing right on the tacks, where you got this horrific close-up of these tacks and blood pouring down the back of Sabu. Thankfully, this was the finish, and Abyss pinned him at 11 minutes and 30 seconds. This was only topped by Don West watching the replay and making this vomiting sound a la Wei Ting watching the China video. Don was great here. And, hey, not always my cup of tea, but this was pretty well done.
Yeah, I completely agree. I thought in terms of the hardcore style, I thought these two did a really good job of it. Meaning, you know, I think what separates this a match like this from your typical WWE hardcore title plunder match is a lot of build up and nice setup of these various spots and satisfying payoffs to those spots, rather than just randomly hitting each other over the head with the, you know, a trash can or whatever random object. I thought, it, you know, it was a little bit of that in this match, but I thought it was, the rest of the match was largely held together by big setups of big table spots, that big thumbtack spot, building anticipation for these big moments before actually delivering them. And, you know, I think a lot of that is attributable to a talent like Sabu, who, you know, not technical really at all, but I thought his fearlessness and, you know, just in, like, just somebody who just didn't hesitate at all when going for these big bumps made these matches very exciting. And I thought Abyss, you know, for somebody who was a pretty much a relative unknown outside of TNA, fit this hardcore style wonderfully. And I just wonder if he was sort of on the scene maybe a decade earlier, how he would have turned out if he had that a run in ECW, where I think he would have been greatly utilized by Paul Heyman.
Yeah, you could tell Sabu was really on his game during this TNA run in 2005. You know, this was a just, I think, everything about this clicked for me. It worked really well. Abyss got the big win. And I don't think this could have come across any better. Shane Douglas is backstage with Alex Shelley. And his teammate, Sean Waltman, is not there. And Shelley says he doesn't know where he is. And together the two had won the Chris Candido Memorial Cup to get a tag title shot.
No, wait. I thought this was the Chris Candido Memorial Cup.
They had won the tournament in order to get the title shot. This was the title shot.
I see. Okay.
So Waltman no-showed the event legitimately. And Tanay explains that Waltman is unpredictable. And you don't know if he's going to show up or not. And then really puts the guilt trip on Waltman over Candido helping younger talent. You would think Waltman would want to do the same here.
Yeah. What was the story here?
The issue with Sean Waltman, they had been working out a contract with him, and they had worked this out, and then he was on his way to Orlando. He had left late in the day, apparently, never showed up, and they couldn't get a hold of this guy for a solid week. He had gone missing, and people were legitimately concerned, like, what happened to this guy? And then they finally tracked him down a week later, and they did not use him. They used him one other time in February of the next year, And then that was it. And for
didn't he come back with Hogan? And
yeah. So years later, he would come back in 2010. But they were pretty much washing their hands of Waltman after this no-show.
Not only washing their hands, but bleaching their hands with the way they were basically, you know, pretty much, I mean, rightfully so, burying the guy on this podcast.
I mean, you could tell Mike Tenay was legitimately pissed was, they had brought in Candido's family. Candido had just passed away a few months before this in April. And a very sad story involving Candido. And here you had Waltman, who had obviously worked a lot with Candido, not showing up, and yeah, they were pissed.
Do you think they were supposed to go over in this?
I can only imagine that given the family was there and everything, mm-hmm. that it would have made sense that Shelley and Waltman would have got a bit of a run with and won the match, being that, you know, they had placed so much on this Chris Candido tournament, give people the, you know, the story to kind of capitalize on the tournament and everything that they put into it.
Don West ends this segment saying, "Some people are all about themselves."
Wow. Yeah, they did not sugarcoat anything with Waltman on this show. Bobby Roode and Jeff Hardy were next. Hardy had been legitimately suspended by TNA after he no-showed the May Hard Justice pay-per-view. So TNA was not having a great stretch with some of these ex-WWE guys, yet they were going head first into bringing as many as they could in.
It's such a strange mix, you know, of talent at the time, where you have, you know, established talent that give off the impression that they're too good for TNA. People that have been around and think maybe this is below them. But then you also have talent like, you know, your Bobby Roode and Alex Shelley's, who were really hungry for opportunities like this.
Yeah, and listen, Jeff Hardy, he would certainly, when WWE announced, it was about a year after this that they brought him back, you know, I didn't even think, why is he getting this chance? His TNA run was horrendous in 2004, 2005. It was just, he just felt like a guy that was a shell of his former self, unprofessional. But he got back to WWE, and he did have the wellness violations in there, but worked super hard. And by the end of that WWE run, he was on fire. And, you know, this TNA run, certainly he had the big issues with the Sting match and everything attached with that. But someone that I think has very much turned people's opinion of him to today, where I think he much more has his head on straight. But a decade ago, also, I was not a fan of Jeff Hardy during this TNA run, and I didn't know why they went to so many lengths with this guy, who I didn't think added a whole lot to these shows. I didn't think he was the level of star that was bringing in a whole ton of people, and there were no shows. And this match, I mean, this was nothing special to me with Bobby Roode. Anyway, so he had been suspended, and this was his first match back in 4 months. Hardy was yanked off the top rope, and Roode is stomping him in the corner, wears down Hardy, works over the back. Hardy fights him back, hits the Whisper in the Wind off the turnbuckle. Very sluggish looking. Yeah. Not the same kind of, you know, that he would have. I mean, not that this guy was a technical marvel, but it was just, it just felt like a guy going through the motions.
It felt like he was kind of just stumbling from spot to spot.
Very uncoordinated. Roode dropped down, and Hardy went to the top when Petey Williams showed up at ringside and hit Hardy with a hockey stick from the floor. Roode then tried for a superplex, suplexes him off after running up with an overhead, the Kurt Angle suplex spot. Williams then distracts the referee, and Hardy knocks Petey off the apron, stops Bobby Roode, who now has the hockey stick, and a twist of fate sends Bobby Roode down to the floor. Hardy climbs to the top, hits a double sledge to both Petey and Bobby on the floor, and then Hardy blocks the Canadian Destroyer on the floor, back body drops Petey Williams, and then Jeff Jarrett appears, hits Hardy with the hockey stick to the back, sends him into the ring, and Bobby Roode pins Hardy at 9 minutes and 8 seconds. Perfect textbook example of a loss that doesn't elevate someone. It's just done to protect the guy losing, and the crowd just shits on it, and it means nothing. I thought this was nothing.
Yeah, just, you know, pretty average. I thought Bobby Roode looked very good, though.
Bobby Roode, I think, 2005, you could certainly see this guy had a ton of potential ahead of him in 2005, absolutely. Douglas is with the Naturals. Andy Douglas and Chase Stevens with their manager, Jimmy Hart. And America's Most Wanted, James Storm and Chris Harris walk in. They exchange words. Harris says there is nothing they can do to stop them. And Not the strongest of promos from anyone here, with the exception maybe of Jimmy. But that's why Jimmy was there.
Yeah, yeah. You could see why the Naturals didn't really speak.
They were not Naturals on the mic. So we had a four-way for the tag titles with the Naturals against America's Most Wanted, against Eric Young and Steak Sauce, and Alex Shelley, who was just going to come out solo. It's an elimination match for the tag titles. They didn't even bother to get a substitute for Shelley. Instead,
they kind of used it to tell the underdog story for Shelley, which I thought could have turned into something interesting.
Even though Shelley, and it was apparent Sean Waltman was not here, Shelley comes out and the graphic still reads both men's names. I guess holding out hope. They show Candido's family at ringside, sitting alongside Dixie Carter, and Andy Douglas brings out Candido's yellow towel because Candido was the manager of the Naturals, so there was that connection as well to that team, and passes it over to the family. Shelley was wearing the three-quarter length tights, the Takamichinoku style tights. Mm-hmm. There was an amazing phenomenon, an A1 chant, including fans at ringside with A1 steak sauce bottles.
Oh, is that right?
So at least they were in on the joke of one of the stupidest names for a performer in TNA history. Team Canada got the heat on Shelley. Tanay just goes to town on Sean Waltman, no showing, as Candido's family came here, says it is sickening. Very out of character for Mike Tanay to go to that length. And you can tell Chris Candido was a very popular figure with TNA. It's a very tragic death, and they felt Sean Waltman was very disrespectful no showing this event.
I imagine Tanay was, you know, delivering the message of the people in the back as well.
Probably. They show Johnny Candido, who's the brother of Chris, who hops the rail to cheer on Alex Shelley, and then he gets asked to be tagged in, and Johnny Candido was an independent wrestler, and everyone just feeds for him until Young low blows him and uses an inside cradle to pin Johnny, and it eliminates both.
Okay, how long was this dude an actual independent wrestler?
It was very infrequent.
Because, I mean, these clotheslines just looked awful, and this bad jump kick. Granted, obviously, the guy didn't come here expecting to wrestle. He didn't have any gear. He didn't train for it. So I don't blame him at all. I thought it was a fun little idea under the circumstances, but the crowd didn't bite at all. First of all, they didn't know who this guy was. You know, like just some random dude who just hops up in the railing. They didn't know he was Chris Candido's brother. Secondly, it doesn't make sense in terms of the rule book. It never makes sense. A referee would never allow a random person, no matter what your affiliation was.
Wasn't licensed by the commission, I bet.
Just to randomly jump into the ring and beat this guy's tag partner. They didn't really explain that, even try to explain that with any tact. And it also killed the underdog story that they were trying to build with Shelley here. It cost Shelley the match.
Yeah, you would definitely be... You could sympathize with the character of Alex Shelley being pissed.
Yeah.
Dude, I was doing fine until you showed up.
What a bad day.
Thanks for the help. So that eliminates both of them. Harris then attempts a vertical suplex on... Oh, sorry. First, Storm hits the Eye of the Storm for a two count on Young, and Team Canada's beating down on Storm. A1 runs him into the post on the floor with his back, and then finally lands a super kick on EY. Harris gets the tag and fires up on everybody. EY is then hit with a vertical suplex. A1 attacks from behind with the hockey stick, and this allows Eric Young to pin Chris Harris and eliminate AMW. So this hockey stick getting a lot of use on this particular show. The Naturals have been out for most of the match up until this point. They get the advantage on Eric Young, and then it turns around, and they get the heat on Andy Douglas. They knock down Jimmy Hart, and then A1 and Stevens. These two looked like they were clones fighting one another. It looked like there was a mirror in between these two. Young then hits a superplex to Douglas. They set up for the Doomsday device, but Jimmy Hart knocks Eric Young off the turnbuckle, allowing them to hit the Natural Disaster on Douglas, and they pin A1.
On A1.
On A1 at 18:01, with Douglas getting the pin.
At 18.
Oh, boy. I'm sure that was done on purpose.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was an okay match. I can't say I was that interested due to my lack of investment in any of the teams. You know, of the bunch, Alex Shelley seemed like he had the most reason to win. The others I just felt completely indifferent to.
The most infuriating of these cutaways was this one because they had the overhead shot as they were getting set to cut to this backstage interview. And you can see the Naturals on the floor going over to Candido's family after winning the match. Mm-hmm. It's like, Christ, like, show this.
Yeah.
And they cut away because we had to get to this Rhino interview,
mm-hmm.
who essentially just cut a promo on how shitty the WWE was, going through 4 years of agony and hell, and no longer has to deal with Hollywood bitches telling him how to display emotion in the ring, and says Raven has what he has always wanted, and he has one word for Raven, and it's pain. Great.
So it is one word.
Yes. Yeah. I thought it was very surprising that Rhino would talk about another promotion because shortly after this, I remember we interviewed Rhino asking him about ECW and were lectured by TNA the next day about why are you asking about ECW? This is we're TNA.
No, did that happen?
This was while Rhino was on TV with the ECW title and putting in a garbage can. Douglas, okay, so we had that promo, and that took us to the NWA title match, meaning that the three-way would be going on last. And apparently this was a late decision.
Really? Wow, okay. This surprised me, because the poster for this show features Raven versus Rhino, and of course this is the NWA title match as well, so I was surprised. Pleasantly so.
Not a decision you can criticize in hindsight.
Nope.
I mean, trying to follow that three-way and the fact that you would have all this bullshit attached to the end of this title match, I think it was an obvious decision to make. Raven and Rhino, Raven's rules match for the NWA title, this rematch that was 4 years in the making from Backlash 2001 for the WWF Hardcore title.
Oh, my God. What a legacy.
Which was actually a very good match, if you go back.
Really?
For hardcore title standards, okay. It was one of the better ones. Raven brought out a shopping cart of weapons, and early on, Raven uses a pizza cutter to slice open the forehead of Rhino, who would bleed throughout the entire match, then used cookie sheets. West made his second warning for the children out there to potentially leave the room. West was very concerned about the young, impressionable youth that might be watching Unbreakable.
Pizza cutters in every kitchen. You got to be careful.
Yeah, these are all household weapons. Rhino used a beer keg as a weapon on the floor. Kids might not be able to get their hands on a beer keg so easily. This looked like this might have been a full keg. The way he hit Raven with it and then tossed it at the post.
I don't know if it was a full keg, man. Even an empty...
Rhino was struggling to hold this up.
Okay.
This was heavy.
Even an empty keg is pretty heavy.
Yeah.
I don't know if you ever lifted one.
So he tosses the keg and misses Raven and hits the post with it. Then uses Raven uses a kendo stick. Raven throughout this match was going for an ankle lock.
Yeah, it was like his move at the time.
I guess he was taking it. Kurt's not here.
He uses the ankle lock. Like some attempt at a technical wrestling move. And the crowd just chants, staple gun, staple gun.
He's like, oh, fuck this submission shit. There was a trash can to the head of Raven on the floor who starts bleeding. Raven goes back to the ankle lock, and it's broken with the trash can. And then Rhino takes the staple gun and staples Raven's head, then uses a chair. He misses a splash from the top, lands on the chair as Raven moves and makes a comeback. Then Cassidy Riley runs down to distract the referee. Raven hits the even flow DDT, gets a two count. Rhino then uses a ladder to the ribs of Raven. The ladder gets lodged on a chair, and it ends with Rhino on top with punches and gets powerbombed onto the ladder for a two count. Rhino then uses the shopping cart as a weapon, and they do the sequence back and forth, and it ends with Rhino, who was supposed to go through the shopping cart. This was right out of the Backlash match, into the shopping cart. Unfortunately, it wasn't really timed well, and you didn't get the visual of Rhino's head going through the bendable part of the end of the shopping cart, so it just looked really dumb.
I wish I saw that Backlash match.
You should have done some research and watched the Backlash match, because they pretty much laid out a more violent version, but the Backlash match was much better executed.
Right, right, right.
So Jarrett shows up again, and he has the title. Jeff Hardy shows up and grabs the title away, and then Raven hits a DDT to Jarrett, then hits Rhino with the DDT. And as Rhino is laying, Raven climbs on top and gets the win at 14 and a half minutes. I'm not going to lie, until this finish, in my head, I thought Raven was the heel and Rhino was the babyface. And it wasn't until the end of the match that I realized Right. Rhino was aligned with Jarrett, and he was the heel, and Raven was the babyface. Though I never got that watching this match.
I don't know if Rhino necessarily was heel, though, because he was aligned with Jarrett, but he also turned on Jarrett in order
kind
to get this title shot. I don't know if it matters all that much in the end, to be honest with you.
Anyway, this match was, to me, Abyss and Sabu blew this match away,
yeah.
And it was very similar how it was laid out, and I just didn't really get into this.
No, and you know, kind of going back to my point about why I like Sabu versus Abyss, this match I just found too much
reliance on the weapons.
I kind of felt numb to, because you know there was no real creativity or build or no story involved in many of the weapons being used. It just felt like people hitting each other in the head with things for the sake of doing so. You know, there were a few couple, you know, cool planned spots, like the attempt at the shopping cart. There's one spot where Raven powerbombs Rhino, or somebody gets powerbombed through a ladder that was stacked and set up. And those are the most memorable things that I think I could take away from the match. Everything else just felt like, you know, just somebody hitting, what's the random object I can pick up? It felt like the video game, WCW Mayhem, like one of the, or what, Backstage Assault. Backstage Assault, one of the worst video games of all time. It's just like a whole game based on
weapons,
and for no reason. Like, part of the fun of these TLC matches and everything, it's not just because of the weapon; it's because of the setup and the creativity involved. And I didn't find much of that in here.
So maybe some people watching it at the time, it was passable, but 10 years later, it received some backlash.
Oh God! But you know, for all that said, I do feel at the time, you know, guys like Raven and Rhino were necessary on this roster, because just even thinking back to that Fight Network party, I mean, you know, as a hardcore fan, we were probably most excited to see guys like Joe, guys like AJ, guys like Daniels. But for a non-TNA fan, you need names that people have heard of, and that includes ECW talent like, you know, Rhino and Raven.
It's a fine balance between, you need to satisfy your current audience and try and grow it while not overlooking the talent that you are investing in. Mm-hmm. That is not going to be a star tomorrow or next week, but 2 years from now, these are the people we will rely on. Yeah. And that, I think, was a fatal flaw of TNA, that they only thought of this week's television rating and not Bound for Glory 2 years from now and the buys it's going to do.
But certainly on this show, it seemed like they kind of were thinking the other way, because they put this match as a semi-main event and they put their new guys in the main event.
I felt it was a very good balance, but look ahead 1 month from this, Bound for Glory, it was supposed to be headlined by Jeff Jarrett and Kevin Nash. That was their direction for their main event of their biggest show of the year. Nash would not work that pay-per-view because of a heart issue, and it ended up actually being Rhino who would win the title that night. And it was just a few days after this particular Unbreakable show that Jeff Jarrett won the NWA title at a Border City Wrestling show of all places.
Wow.
And then they would show the footage on the Spike show, and Jeff Jarrett went into the Spike era as the NWA champion. And certainly he drew a lot of criticism for having, for so many years, being the guy that they built around, and arguing that, you know, he really wasn't top heel material as the number one guy.
I wouldn't even say he really had the cachet of somebody like, you know, a Rhino or somebody that you actually, an established guy that you look forward to seeing. Not even a huge knock against Jarrett, but it just, I don't think he deserved that main spot.
So then we had a video for the main event, and you know, for all the talk about you know, the personality and characters, the promos in this video from Christopher Daniels were great. Right down to, his heart is six-sided and it beats TNA. TNA. I mean, he really had a handle on the Fallen Angel character. And
so wasn't he a heel, though?
He was a heel at this point in
time.
But
yet he still, like, cuts a promo like that?
It was still very much heel promos about the, I always thought it was very fascinating, the promos he cut, and essentially ditching that whole Fallen Angel character, which I thought was an excellent character, and reinvented himself as more of the, with more comedy with Frankie Kazarian years later. And it was the idea that at the time they thought, Christopher Daniels, he's a great worker, but no personality. I never bought into that with Christopher
Daniels.
What
do they say about all these guys?
I think that's very lazy for a lot of them, that they have to overcome this stigma that they all inherit because they're talented in the ring, but I mean, I looked at Christopher Daniels as certainly a guy that had a lot of character on top of the talent inside the ring. So our three-way was Christopher Daniels defending the X Division title against Samoa Joe, who had debuted earlier in the year, and AJ Styles.
Still hasn't been pinned.
No, has point. Not been beaten in TNA as of yet, and would go another year before he would be beat. Styles and Joe double-team Daniels when the bell rings, and they're one-upping each other with kicks to the back. Joe with a variation of the Rings of Saturn on Styles as Daniels breaks it up. You know, I enjoyed this a lot because it was our typical three-way where constantly any submission, it was the guy being able to make the save. I never thought they overdid it, but they did it enough to emphasize the three-way nature of the match. Joe set up for the Olay kick, and Daniels cut him off with his shoulder block, sending him to the floor and followed with a split-legged moonsault to the floor onto Joe. This crowd was reacting to this match as if it was very special immediately.
They started to stand up for everything in this match.
Yeah, this did not just feel like another X Division match that, talented guys. It was pretty evident. I mean, everyone was hitting everything. Yeah. It felt flawless. The announcers knew right away that this was something important. And it was in the main event position, so automatically you told the audience, this is special.
Yeah, and even watching this match back, you really kind of felt that too, a few minutes into this, you realize that this was going to be something special, like you're about to watch a pitcher throw a no-hitter, you know what I mean? You knew these guys were doing everything so perfectly, you're just waiting for one thing to botch, one thing to screw up, and didn't really show up here.
Yeah, with Daniels and Joe on the floor, Styles then hit a springboard shooting star to the floor. Daniels then monkey flipped Styles into a Hurricane Rana onto Joe out of the corner. Huge TNA chant as a result of that. A chant I cannot recall the last time I heard. Joe applied the Coquina clutch to Daniels, and Styles broke it with the spiral tap off the top. That just looks like a crazy move because you can hardly control your landing, and you're just landing on the guy who's on top of Daniels at the particular time. Then we had Daniels in the Tree of Woe. Joe connected with the Olay kick. Mike Tenay was so excited calling this. Mm-hmm. The crowd's reacting to every spot. They went nuts even when Joe just hit a simple senton to Styles. Daniels and Styles then fought on the floor. Joe hit a twisting plancha to both. West says we are seeing one of the greatest matches in history, which was not hyperbole from Don West in terms of TNA history. Big striking exchange between Joe and Styles. An elevated German delivered to Styles and then hit the muscle buster. Daniels grabs the title but runs into a Joe power slam. Joe grabs the title and then there's an enziguri to Joe from Daniels and the title hits Joe in the head. Daniels follows that with the best moonsault ever to Styles. Joe saves. Then Joe goes back to the floor and Daniels hits a superplex to Styles and Joe crawls back as he gets a two count on both men. It continues to pick up. There was a Pele kick from Styles to Joe. He applied the torture rack to Joe into a spinning slam off his shoulders for a two count. And then we got into the finishing sequence as Styles rolled through and hit a Styles clash to Daniels. Joe made the save. Joe then missed Daniels and flies to the floor. And Daniels gets up to his feet, goes for the Angel's wings, which Styles blocks. And he suplexes Daniels and bridges on top with the underhook still applied and catches Daniels with the bridge and pins him at 22 minutes and 50 seconds. And Styles becomes a 5-time X Division champion. A pretty much flawless match.
Mm-hmm.
It totally holds up 10 years later. Yep. As this match that was incredible at the time, and 10 years later you go watch back, and it holds up to me 100%.
Yeah, and flawless, more impressive by the fact that they were going so fast. This was, to me, really embodied the X Division style that I think will be remembered as, TNA, perhaps TNA's biggest contribution that'll be positively remembered. Is this just no breaks, no rest spots, a typical WWE three-way, I think you'll often find two guys in the ring, one guy stays outside for a long, long time. This wasn't really that. This was just total nonstop. Whatever.
Momentum.
And I just thought, you know, all three guys were just so perfect. It almost felt like none of these three were capable of doing something that didn't look good, didn't look perfect. They planned some very intricate, elaborate spots, and they hit everything. They hit everything. I thought Joe's addition to the X Division, I thought just kind of made everything so much better. His role here, if it was just AJ and Daniels, I think it would just be seen as a cruiserweight matchup. But Joe's addition as the heavy guy who can, you know, work that stiff style but do it all really fast added, I thought, a lot of legitimacy to the point where you can take this as not just a cruiserweight match but just a match, a great, great match. And I thought they were all tremendous here. Yeah, just probably the best match in TNA history.
I mean, such a great blueprint of, I think, TNA saying, hey, we've got something so different. This isn't going to change the industry overnight, but we have something here, and we have access to all of this great talent that can facilitate this kind of professional wrestling. They would hit on the Knockouts division a few years later, and were years ahead of the WWE on that front with the X Division guys. It's just, you look at so much that they had on the table for themselves, and mm-hmm. being able to bring in a guy like Kurt Angle that would legitimately bring a lot of interest to your product of people that maybe had not sampled TNA yet. It just seemed like they had so much readily available to them at this point in time, and about to jump onto a platform where they were going to be able to access a million viewers every week. It's just, it was both enjoyable to go back and watch this show, but also sad in many other regards. But at this point, it's going to make us very happy to go back to the night of September 11th, 2005, and hear some comments from the Law that night involving Jeremy Borash just about an hour or so after this three-way main event at the Impact Zone.
Jeremy, how are you tonight?
I am honored to be on the program, guys. Thanks. I'd like to start this off by saying that it being, I believe, my first time on your program, that I would go out with the intention right now of becoming your best guest ever, and I'm going to tell you how I'm going to do that tonight.
Wow.
I have assembled a cavalcade of stars for you to talk to tonight, in addition to myself. I know,
wow.
I might be able to carry the interview myself, but no, I have actually assembled a cavalcade of stars.
Well, you know, I do have a lot of stuff that I did want to talk about. First off, just congratulations on another solid pay-per-view tonight. Pretty solid action from top to bottom. Of course, the three-way, the match was outstanding as well. A great piece of work. You guys got to be pretty happy overall with the way the pay-per-views and TNA in general has been playing out the last little while.
Ecstatic about it. You know, and I think one thing that we have come to, what we really have to do, and we have no other choice, is to every month deliver. And the guys know that, and the work shows. The writing is coming together. I'm real happy with the writing now, and I think we're building up such a fever pitch now going into this Spike TV launch that we're going to come on real strong.
Mm-hmm.
And without a doubt, the best thing to happen to the wrestling business since Nitro went off the air will be some competition, and
yes.
That's exactly
yes.
what we intend to do.
Absolutely.
Now, guys, I hate to jump on, but I am striving to be the best guest ever. I am right now going to deliver an alumni to the program, a man who tonight was not victorious but still undefeated. I'm going to hand the phone over to Samoa Joe. Okay.
Cool.
All right, here he is.
Joe, how's it going?
Hey, shut up! I'll read it. get off me, Borash. I'll read it.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, go ahead. Joe,
I just
want
to. Hey, Dan, I would just like to say that you potentially have one of the best guests in the history of this program on tonight in Jeremy Borash, and you should very much look forward to the humorous and witty banter and joyful childlike anecdotes that he will provide.
Wow.
To you and your listeners.
Now, Joe, yeah. I think you should stick to just putting over wrestlers.
Yeah, seriously, because he's a nice, sad little.
You can. I'm just gonna say one thing, Joe. Another fantastic match tonight. Another spectacular match tonight. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Give the phone back to Jeremy now.
Yes. Okay. In closing, I'd also like to say that Jeremy Borash could possibly be one of the most handsome ring announcers since Gary Michael Capetta.
Oh!
That was a little weird.
Woo!
All right, here's Jeremy.
All right.
All right, guys. Thank you, Joe. I appreciate it.
Okay. You mentioned the TNA, the Spike deal. Obviously, everybody's really excited about that. What's that done for morale? Because you guys were definitely on a rocky road up until about just a couple of months ago.
We have been on a rocky road since day one. I'm not afraid to say that. I'm not ashamed to say that. What hasn't killed us has definitely made us stronger. And morale has, you know, I mean, one, I don't think it's ever been down because everybody's so hungry about it. Sure, we get, you know, kicked along the way, but we just come back stronger, I think, and we've shown that over time. I mean, you know, there are things about us from the early days that I'd rather forget, but there is also some great stuff that helped us become what we are now, and
right.
We're entering in the next stage. We've always just progressed to the next level, and while people have said different things about TNA along the way, one thing you can always say is we've been persistently aggressive in advancing the company.
Right. So what kind of plans do you have in motion for that big debut? I would assume that's the focus now that you've gotten Unbreakable out of the way, that now the focus is going to be that big debut on Spike.
Well, the focus is how do we introduce the TNA product best, and what is the TNA product to introduce to the masses? It's a whole different ballgame. Spike TV will... really, and then with our Eurosport deal now, too, we're in Europe. We're all over Europe now. We're about to unravel a whole new style of wrestling to a bunch of people, a bunch of fans who have given up or have not been interested in what they've been seeing lately. And, you know, one thing that's been real interesting to watch is people seeing the current TNA product as wrestling for the first time in a long time.
Right.
And the excitement they get out of that. And, you know, there were a certain couple of individuals tonight backstage, a certain... Mark and Devon, two individuals
right,
that you may
right.
have heard of before that were backstage tonight.
Yep.
And said, this feels like ECW all over again.
Interesting.
And, you know, I think the thing that you can kind of take from that is we're all hungry and we're all just, we're in it to win it. And you know, maybe we're not head to head or, you know, what are we in terms of competition now? But we're damn sure ready to go there.
And we're ready to see it take off. And definitely, I like the idea of introducing all this new talent to wrestling fans that might not be familiar with them. But I have to ask this, Jeremy, because I really am. I'm kind of concerned about this myself, in that the fact that you're going to use Kevin Nash as part of the Spike debut, and to me, to separate your product as something different, I don't know if you should be using older stars like that, and whether they have any cachet in 2005.
Well, you know, in a lot of things, you know, when you're bringing something new to the table, you've got to use things to hook fans to what you really are. And sometimes, you know, Kevin Nash's, no doubt his notoriety, for wrestling fans who were, you know, we're really trying to track is not necessarily the WWE fan. We're trying to affect, and bring in the 5 million whatever viewers that have tuned away, you know, and bringing them something fresh and something different, bring them back to the sport. You know, WWE can have their fans, and that's a huge amount of fans, but what about the 5 million that haven't been watching since Nitro went off the air?
Right.
What are they doing now?
But well, especially, yeah, but wait a minute, especially those 5 million, do they want to see Kevin Nash? I mean, come on, he was one of the guys that killed that company.
Well, you know, Kevin isn't necessarily the only thing you're going to see on TNA.
No.
You know, maybe for every person that doesn't want to see Kevin Nash, they're going to stick around to see AJ Styles.
Okay.
We've offered, you know, a good variety of things, and you know, there is definitely something to be said for name value. And we've always been, whether it's Randy Savage or Sting, we've always tried to mix some good names that people are familiar with.
Right.
Maybe not in the prominent roles, maybe in the prominent roles. You know, take it each case individually. But the ultimate goal is to bring people to the TNA product that you saw tonight in the main event.
Right, absolutely. You mentioned that Mark and Devon were backstage tonight. Any firmed up stuff with them? Will TNA be working with them, or is you still have issues to work out with who owns what name or whatever?
Well, now there's no issue there because the WWE owns the name that they were formerly known by.
Right.
And there's no dispute about that. The, you know, the situation is we'll see as it gets closer to the Spike TV debut. But there were a number of people backstage today that were former employees of that organization.
Right.
Guys, I don't mean to change subject on it. This is Borash's Cavalcade of Stars.
Okay. Who's
can
next?
Can I drop another one on you?
Who's next?
Boy, he is not having a good night tonight, but he is still committed to being on the program and helping me out as your best guest ever, hopefully. Ladies and gentlemen, the former X Division champion of the world, the Fallen Angel, Christopher Daniels. I'll hold the phone over now. Here you go.
All right. Chris, how you doing?
Well, I can't say it's my best night. But I fought hard, and at the end of the night, I had my head held high.
I mean, again, you were involved in another fantastic match. I mean, you know, winner, loser, regardless of that, it was another fantastic match.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
I also got to see your match up here in Oshawa a couple of weeks ago when you fought Petey Williams and Chris Sabin, which I thought was another great match.
Ah, thank you. Those were better days because I won that match.
Yes, you ran out of there like the true cowardly heel that you are with that title clutched firmly against your chest.
The best part of that was the fact that I air guitared with my belt.
That was good. I did enjoy that as well.
I made
Absolutely.
Bobby Roode a very happy man. That was part of my night.
So what happens for Chris Daniels now, I guess, to try to get that X title back? Or what's happening with you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, TNA's got to understand that as Mr. TNA, I'm still firmly entrenched in the chase for the X Division title. And one pinfall does not end my hold on that belt. So AJ Styles at some point will have to give me a rematch, and hopefully it's as soon as possible. So definitely that's my point.
And you've got to be happy about the whole Spike thing as well, right?
Oh, definitely, definitely. I'm looking forward to bringing a new audience to TNA and being part of that. We got to see a lot of the Spike TV executives tonight, and we heard nothing but positive reinforcement from them. And to know that they're behind us as strong as they are, it really gives us a little extra effort. It gives us a little extra gas in the tank to go out there and really put on a good show and then really really show them that their confidence is well-placed.
Right. And one quick question before we go back to Jeremy. Are you going to be the one working with Jushin Liger on the Bound for Glory pay-per-view?
I'm not sure, man. It just depends. I may have to – that may be the night that I get my title rematch from AJ, but if I have to wrestle Jushin Liger to get there, then that's what I'll do.
All right.
I've told everybody that I'm the best in the world. If I have to prove it against one of Japan's best, then I'll do it. If I get my title rematch against AJ, I'll do it. If I have to wrestle Joe, I'll do it. I'm just out there showing everybody that I'm the best X Division wrestler in the world today. So,
good work, Brian. All right, continued success, and we'll put us back with Jeremy there.
All right, man. Thanks.
Okay,
God
cool.
bless the law.
All right.
Hey, I would just like to – there was a discussion, a debate.
Oh, yeah.
On what was the greatest TNA main event of all time? And I said this next to both Daniels and Skipper. Was it tonight or was it the cage match?
Wow. That's
your opinion.
That's a tough one, man. The cage match was good, but I really liked tonight's match a lot. I thought it was really smart for you guys to put the X Division match last.
Okay. Well, I just told Daniels that. He said, don't tell your Skipper that, please. All right. Thank you, Chris.
That was Jeremy Borash from September 11th, 2005, the night of Unbreakable on The Law. Just hours after the pay-per-view concluded. Now, Mr. Ting, we went back in time. We're going to go to another reunion. Are you ready? You're not getting up to go to the bathroom for this one, correct?
I'm not.
I want you here for this.
I will be here.
Okay. It's been a long time mm-hmm. since I've heard this opening theme. I'm very excited that once again we can hear from the man himself, who was not a tag team in TNA, James Brown. So welcome back, The Godfather.
One, two, three, hit it! TNA! TNA!
TNA! TNA! Hey! I got something that makes me want to shout. I'm just about the happiest man in the world right now.
It's all right.
It's all right, man. It's about a 6 out of 10.
The familiar theme way brings us back. This is a first. This guy, Nate Milton, joining us on Review Away. Such an important event that Way has stuck around for this segment. We are proud to be joined by TN8 himself here on Review Away. Brother Nate, how are you?
What's going on, brothers? It is good to be here for one night only, and unlike some of the TNA one-night-onlys, or most of the TNA one-night-onlys, who am I kidding? People are actually excited about this thing, so it's good to be here to finally be on the mothership, if you will, and it's good for Way to be here, because I missed you, Way.
Likewise.
I think when you're Nate here, we have to call it, it's not the mothership, it's the brothership when Nate comes on board.
I like it. I think I might be making a bold statement here, John, but I think I'll go ahead and say that this part right here, this is the second best three-way that we're going to talk about on the show tonight.
Okay, I didn't know where you were going with that when you started. So, We are going to chat about Unbreakable. It's a very strenuous time in TNA history, but going back to September of 2005, you know, beyond the three-way, Nate, was there anything about this show that you recalled before we even mentioned to you about coming onto the show and discussing this event beyond the three-way? Because I'll be honest, that was the key thing I think 99% of people remember about this show and of TNA history.
I mean, the three-way is definitely the main event, both in actuality and in terms of the history of TNA. You know, it's still one of the company's, if not the company's, best-remembered matches. And I remember the three-way, and I remembered Raven and Rhino, and everything else was just a blur. Like, I went back and watched the show, and it made me feel a very strong sense of bittersweetness. You know, I saw lots of old friends and lots of old faces, and I'm just going through them like, hey, Elix Skipper, I remember you. And hey, Monty Brown, how you doing, old buddy? And Sabu, is that you? And then, you know, just seeing where they were in 2005 and where the company now stands 10 years later, it's a bittersweet feeling.
I think that you go back and you watch this show, and everything is ahead of this company at this point. They're just weeks away from debuting on Spike TV. I think it's very easy to make the automatic comparison to what NXT is doing at this point. TNA was in a very different position at that time, but there were a lot of parallels for me watching this show at this point where, you know, it wasn't a whole lot of household names that populated this roster, but they had a very dedicated fan base, and they were presenting something that could seriously be looked at as an alternative in 2005 as opposed to what TNA would eventually grow into.
Not only that, John, but I think that in 2005, we kind of got our first glimpse of how good AJ Styles was as a performer. And even though he was still very young, still in kind of the formative stages of becoming the performer that we now know and love in New Japan, he had so many great matches, not just the three-way at Unbreakable, but I remember him and Joe having a singles match at, I want to say, Turning Point. That was pretty good. He was even able to get some good matches out of Abyss in 05. And it's like, man, this guy was yours. You had him. He was not on the WWE's radar, you know, and JR has a great podcast where he openly talks about missing the ball on AJ Styles. And it's like, man, if you guys had just cultivated this talent instead of every time he seemed to get momentum, you wanted to pull the rug from under him. You wanted to put him in there in a Ric Flair robe. You wanted to have Clint Lynch say that she's got AJ's baby. You wanted to have Dixie Carter talk down to your top star and make him run away and drive off in a motorcycle with a real bad beard. And it's like, you have one of the greatest wrestlers in the world, not just back then, but today, and you wasted a lot of his prime.
What would you say was the main reason you tuned in every week to an episode of a TNA production? What was the hook for you?
I think it was probably half out of loyalty to hating the WWE product. So, you know, being from Virginia and being born in Atlanta, you know, I'm NWA, WCW still to this day. That's been my favorite wrestling company to watch as a whole, even though I know you and John still have some scars from some of those WCW 2000 shows you had to review. But I was such a big fan of those guys and girls that wrestled for WCW, and a lot of them wound up wrestling for Jeff Jarrett and TNA, and so that was kind of the initial hook. But then the X Division was the thing that made me become a fan of TNA, put on that TNA jersey and just become a TNA diehard for so many years, because when you've got talent like Daniels and Joe and Low Ki and Elix Skipper and Chris Sabin and Alex Shelley, and these are all young, well, Daniels wasn't young, but he was still pretty damn good back then. You got young, hungry guys for the most part who have been given this national platform, and it was markedly different than the product that WWE was providing at the time. And so I think that's why I rode so hard for TNA for so long, because they were, I'd say from 02 through 06, they really were an alternative, but unfortunately they kept getting in their own way a lot of the time.
Now, it's really easy to go back to an event like Unbreakable, and you can watch it through rose-colored glasses. Certainly, the three-way speaks for itself. What did you not like going back and watching this show? Because they were throwing a lot of stuff at the wall at this point, trying to gain traction, trying to find an audience. What did you not like about Unbreakable?
Oh, man. There's so many things that I did not like about the early days of TNA. Most of them would probably fall at the feet of your good buddy Vince Russo.
But this was all pre-Vince Russo. This was all, you know, during the supposed glory days of TNA in 2005. But it was hardly a flawless product.
No, and I think part of the issue was that even before Russo, but I think it certainly became an exacerbated problem after Russo got there, was that this has always been a company, even now in 2015, that has never had a clear-cut identity. Are they a Southern promotion? Are they a cruiserweight promotion? Are they a TNA promotion? No pun intended. You know, what are they, a hardcore promotion? What is this company? Who are their fan base? Who are we trying to cater to? And so while you have great matches like AJ Styles and Daniels and Samoa Joe, we also get, you know, Shark Boy and some indie dude on the card. We also get BG James and Conan for some damn reason in 2005. You know, it's this weird thing that I think they never really were able to grasp who their audience was. And if they did know who their audience was, they didn't really try hard to cater to them. Because if you look at this card and so many other cards throughout that early period of TNA, the biggest reactions were always for those X Division guys. And unfortunately, I think they gave it some importance. They gave it a hell of a lot of importance on cards like this, but they did not sustain it. And pretty soon thereafter, they would fall into the trap of bring in recently released WWE guy X, Y, or Z, and he's going to be our big star. And they started to alienate the fan base.
Hmm. Were you a fan of the Rhino versus Raven match on this show?
I thought Raven was really good around this time, but I've never been a fan of Rhino. Like, I'm sure he's a very nice guy. I'm sure he'd be excellent at a garden party or something like that. But I've just never been a fan of Rhino, even at his prime. You know, in ECW, I was never that into the guy. So I thought it was an okay match, but it wasn't. The quality of match that I thought TNA should be having at that time for, you know, your world championship match.
You know, Nate, if you were ringside at Unbreakable and you were sitting in between Johnny Candido and Dixie Carter, and Dixie leans over and she says, "Hey, look, Nate Milton's here. Nate, what do you think about our product? What do you think should be some of our... What should some of our goals be when we go to Spike TV? Because we do want to grow this audience. We want people to be aware of TNA. What would your advice have been to a young, impressionable Dixie Carter in 2005 as she was on her feet chastising heel Jeff Jarrett during Unbreakable?
Oh, that's an excellent question, John. And I think the first thing I would say to Dixie is, where's Surge? Because this is future Nate going back in time, and I don't want to get punched like AJ Styles did that one night.
That's true.
You know, hey, Surge, I'm just giving your wife business advice. It's nothing personal. But I think the main things that I would say are, A, focus on the talent. Focus on what got you here. Focus on these guys in the X Division and the girls that are going to be coming up in the Knockouts Division. Give them a platform and present them as stars. The second thing I would say is, if Vince Russo calls you, don't pick up that phone. The third thing I would say is, Dixie, for the benefit of the company and for the business at large, the thing that you probably need to do the most that will give you the most success is swallow your pride, is realize when you make mistakes, and realize who to trust, because I don't think everything that's been wrong with TNA is Dixie's fault, but I do think that a lot of what's wrong with TNA is that she has put her faith in the wrong people over and over again.
Is this a salvageable situation at this point, Nate? Whether or not they find a new television deal, do you still have faith that this thing can become –
a sustainable product that we're still talking about 5 years from now that can somehow find its place in wrestling, become profitable at some level? Or is it so far gone at this point, Nate, that you don't believe it can?
That's another good one, John. That's a tough one because
I brought my A game today for you.
Yeah, I mean, you're not the best in the business for nothing, sir.
That's way.
You get two way. Whoa. I think there's still some animosity here with me and Wade because all of those times when I was just here at my house in Virginia waiting for Wade to come through that door and he never showed up. It was like, how many times can Santa Claus not come down the chimney?
Well, there's a reason Christmas happens once a year. It's more special.
But to your question, you know, you want me to give a prognostication on the future of Impact.
I mean, long term, can this work? This thing that is TNA Wrestling, can this work at any level in the future?
Well, I'm going to keep it 100 with you, John. I think that as long as Dixie Carter is there, it's a blessing and a curse because having Dixie in TNA means that there will be some influx of money, even though Panda Energy has tightened the purse strings, they'll still have some type of financial backing, and they will have somebody who is palatable in terms of meeting with TV executives and broadcast networks. But the curse of Dixie Carter is, I think that she does not know when to step back. She does not know when to allow those that have experience, those that have knowledge, you know, a Paul Heyman, a Gabe Sapolsky, a Jim Ross, you know, Jeff Jarrett a year ago when he wanted to buy the company. She does not know how to step back and say, okay, this is something that I bought into. This is something that I care deeply about. But in order for it to thrive and flourish and be put in the best position for success, I need to take a step back. And until she does that, this company could get, you know, a deal on WGN or some small network or local cable access or be an internet show, and they'll be around, but will they be relevant? And I think that's the bigger question. It's not a matter of just surviving because if at the end of the day, if you're just surviving and you can't pay your talent, you can't pay your crew, what good are you doing for the business? You know, you don't just want to survive, you want to thrive. And unfortunately, as much as I have been a fan of TNA for so many years, I don't see a scenario where they thrive if Dixie Carter is still there.
The man is Nate Milton. You can hear him every Friday night here at LiveAudioWrestling.com, and it is the series finale of Review and Impact this Friday night as Brian Mann and Nate Milton are going to shut one door. But Nate, you two, 1 week later, in true wrestling fashion, are going to come back and open up a brand new door. So why don't you tell the listeners what is in store for the future of yourself and Brian Mann over the next few weeks?
Yes, Brian and I have lost a Loser Leaves Town match with TNA, so we're going to disappear for a week and then come back, much like Charlie Brown from Out of Town.
I thought you would say like Ric Flair came back in drag after the loss to Hogan.
Oh, see, I was trying to make it through this whole segment, John, without mentioning Hulk Hogan.
Oh, it's been a rough summer for the Hulkster, but yeah, hard to talk about TNA history without mentioning Hogan.
Yeah, again, Dixie, you got to know who to trust. But speaking of people you can trust, speaking of people who will keep it real, who will keep it honest, who will speak openly, that's going to be me and Brian Mann on a show called Keep It 100. And we're really excited about the project. We've done a couple interviews already. We got them in the can, and we hope that you enjoy the new show. It's not going to be a review show, so to speak. It's going to be more of a thematic show. As Brian said on The Law, you know, if The Law shows, the review shows are like The Daily Show, we want this to be like The John Oliver Show, where we can take a little bit more in-depth look at a specific topic every week and bring you some cool and interesting and fun guests and give you a bit of our silly banter and sometimes our inflammatory opinions. But it's going to be cool. And this first week on October 9th, this theme is going to be debuts. So we've got two big guests. I think you guys are going to enjoy it, and it'll be a lot shorter than 2.5 hours every week, so we got that going for us, which is nice.
Who are the guests?
I can't tell you, Wade, because it's part of the mystery. Unlike TNA, we're gonna pay off this mystery opponent. But I can tell you that our first guest, the first non-Brian or Nate voice you hear on the show, he's going to be pretty cool.
Wow. Okay, well, there's the tease from our own Nate Milton. You can follow the man on Twitter at N8
M-O-Z-A-I-K. He does about 5 million shows. But his number one priority is here at LiveAudioWrestling.com every Friday with Brian Mann, so you can tune in this week, the final edition of Review and Impact. And Nate, it's great catching up with you. Last question, how far are the Blue Jays going to go in the playoffs this season?
Oh, yeah, because I know you and Way are, you're like the new official podcast for the Blue Jays.
Of course we are. We're going to talk about the Blue Jays every single show as long as they are in contention.
Well, first of all, thanks for having me back. Thanks for having me on, you know, the first time. It's a big night in the career of one Nate Milton, and I appreciate you guys for everything you do on and off the air. But in terms of the Blue Jays, I think they've got a realistic shot. They've got a good pitching staff. Tulo is a bit banged up, but I really like the way that lineup looks. And I'm going to say, for all the people listening out there in Toronto, the Blue Jays will at least make it to the World Series. I'm not saying they will win the World Series, but they will make it to the Fall Classic.
That is a bold prediction from Nate Milton, but he always tells it like it is, and we appreciate him for stopping by on this very packed edition of Review Away. Thank you very much for stopping by, Nate.
Thanks for having me, guys. Hey, Way, it was nice. It was nice talking to you again.
Just like old times.
Yeah. Oh, dude, I will cherish this moment forever.
Always great chatting with Nate Milton.
Always great, and unfortunately, perhaps the last time we'll be talking to TN Nate.
Oh, that's right. Man, I thought you were going to say the last time we'll ever talk to him.
No.
Like, man,
no,
what a dire end note.
Brother Milton, I'll still say hi.
Yeah, I guess I don't know if there's another promotion that lends itself so much to TN Nate, who we first met just through our message board.
No, he used to call... Oh, you're right.
That was our first interaction.
Didn't he used to call him a lot?
It was pre-message board. It was Facebook, the Facebook group.
Okay. Because didn't he used to call in on the law? We should have asked him.
It was on Facebook. I remember because it was the Monday night. It was Raw and Impact on Monday nights.
Yes.
And I remember he would go on, and my God, did this guy just defend everything TNA did. And I would just go back and forth with him. But it was always like a just... respectful back and forth where I just about always disagreed with him. And then finally you were missing a week and I was like, this guy would be great to come on.
Was that how it happened?
Yes.
Wow.
And then a staple of the Law family.
Oh, yeah.
So at this point, we're going to move on over to your feedback to Unbreakable. And there was a handful of you that chimed in. So we will go to Alan Jones, who starts things off.
Alan Jones, isn't that?
Alan Jones. Before I start,
can talk about his own match.
Yeah, maybe okay. It is. Before I start, I just want to say that it's great to have Nate finally on Review Away, as it's long been overdue. Anyway, the main event will get the majority of acclaim for this show, and rightly so. Their chemistry is off the charts. You just don't see three ways of that caliber anymore. Having said that, other than the main event, there's nothing on this show worth going out of your way to see. There's a couple good matches on the undercard, but they've been done better. Petey and Sabin, Raven against Rhino. As a whole, this pay-per-view will live in infamy thanks to its main event, which would have been worth the admission alone, not due to its lackluster undercard. 7 out of 10.
We got a Matt who says, TNA Unbreakable was a very solid pay-per-view, showcasing the younger talent and showing a wrestler who I feel WWE missed an opportunity with, Monty Brown. Scott D'Amore had a very solid booking plan that led to events outside the Impact Zone. Two questions. If TNA didn't bring in Vince Russo after Bound for Glory 06, how much farther do you think D'Amore's booking would have taken TNA?
I mean, Scott D'Amore was certainly one of the key creative figures, but it was very much a committee at this point with others involved. Jeff Jarrett had involvement. Mike Tenay was involved as well. I will say that when they did announce that they were going to be changing the creative staff, I mean, by mid-2006, TNA was certainly not firing to me on all cylinders as they had in 2005, where it was all very fresh ideas. And by mid-2006, I was not opposed to a creative change or slight changes. I would have wanted Scott D'Amore still involved. However, the alternative of what happened with Vince Russo coming in, I mean, the proof was in the pudding. That, to me, was the ultimate turning point for TNA in late 2006. It was in that same span where you had Kurt Angle come in and you also had Vince Russo return to the company. And the next few years, to me, it was just they were creatively bankrupt to me. And I think they really stopped moving forward and they became this promotion that was just simply
they were chasing after the leader in WWE, trying their best to mimic them, and it was just there to me was not enough of an audience for that, and it bared itself out with their business.
His second question: if TNA survives another cancellation, do you think they could go a route with only showcasing the X Division?
Not at this point. I don't feel they've made enough guys. I mean, their roster is so small at this point that moving forward, I think that just to scale down to X Division guys, you would have to bring in more people. I mean, you have a skeleton crew at this point in TNA. I don't think you could necessarily cut off some of your other talent at this point and go an all X Division route. I mean, that X Division, let's be honest, it has not been a significant part of TNA for 9 years at this point. And it's always been the idea of going back to what worked once. And it wasn't so much the concept as it was having the right guys in that division that made it click for a number of years. Derek from Denton, Texas. Hey guys, I hope your day is going good. This show has one of my favorite X Division matches on it. Around the time of Unbreakable, I was barely getting into TNA, and the Triple Threat match was the match that got me hooked to the X Division. The rest of the matches were fine, and I always enjoy watching Chris Sabin and Petey Williams go up against each other, and gives the show 7 out of 10. Question is, besides the AJ, Joe, and Daniels feud, are there any other X Division feuds that you guys are fans of? I certainly involved all of the stuff that Jerry Lynn... and his involvement in the X Division prior to this time period was great. The stuff with AJ Styles, I thought he was a huge reason of why the X Division got off to the level it did. Low-key had a big involvement. Amazing Red became this great kind of underdog hero to everyone when they were taping in Nashville. He was they did a great job with Amazing Red in the Nashville days as well. But it was, to me, it was all pre-2005 where they had many different guys coming in and showcased.
We go to Trent from Texas, who says, Road Dogg has been responsible for some of the most embarrassing and cringeworthy moments in the history of wrestling. On this show, he had a moment that only added to that legacy. After 3 Live Crew 1, Road Dogg lied on the middle rope like he was about to take a 619. And looked straight at the camera and started lip-syncing their theme song. He couldn't have looked douchier or more like an asshole in the way he was doing it. I advise everybody to go back and watch it. Okay. I did not catch this.
He was just like bobbing his head to the song. I mean, I don't know what was so notable about it. MJ, hey guys, this show was just before I got back into wrestling in 06-07. I had followed WWE from afar, but it was... And then... It was hearing about matches like this three-way that actually got me to tune into TNA on Spike and really get back into wrestling. Never would I have thought that in 2015 I'd never watched Impact and the company would be on the brink. It really is a shame TNA couldn't ever live up to its raw potential, which was on full display in that main event.
Okay, Rory from Dundee, Scotland.
Wow.
Has actually quite a bit to say, but he's got a big story about how the main event is an important part of his wrestling fandom. As a younger man, I didn't get into wrestling until mid-2004. At that point, watching exclusively WWE, I was encased in the WWE bubble, but in late 2005, early 2006, after I had happened upon a VHS copy of the One Night Stand pay-per-view, and specifically the awesome Masato Tanaka match, it led him online to read about the Wrestling Observer and Dave Meltzer's 5-star matches. He decided to take a look and found the most recent 5-star match being this one from Unbreakable. Not even knowing who these three were, the athleticism was breathtaking, and I was in awe. Breath-tasty, and I was in awe. I don't remember exactly how long after that I started following TNA, but it opened up my eyes to life outside the WWE. And in time, I found and loved ROH, PWG, New Japan, ICW, etc. It's possible if this match hadn't connected with me on such a level, I would never have ventured outside my WWE comfort zone. And in the years where my interest in them has waned and used the indies to sustain me, I may not even be a fan anymore. So whatever it's worth, TNA's legacy to me, for all the good and the bad, will always be that moment where I realized that there was more to wrestling than SmackDown repeats and made me the fan I am today.
All right, from there, we will go to Bill from Hamilton. This show was special for me, as despite seeing several TNA shows and pay-per-views, this was actually the first one I ordered and watched live as it happened. Even though I had explored
most major avenues of wrestling by 2005, be it WWE or the days of the territories, Japan or the Indies, nothing could have prepared me for the greatest. That was Joe Daniels and Styles. To this day, one of the greatest matches I have ever seen, pure excitement and action and nothing but. Even before his run in TNA, I knew Joe was something special, having snagged VHS copies from tape traders of his matches with Punk. It's easy to see why this guy was arguably the biggest non-WWE star at the time, because he had a unique presence as a character, and also it should be fair to point out that he wasn't the prototypical Samoan character that we'd been seeing on national television since the 70s, which also added to his appeal. He was a guy who looked like he could rip you in half when the bell was rung. That's pretty much what you got from him. TNA was better when it was merely an alternative to the WWE, not a company trying to be their competition. Everything that happened in the following years has been sad, but it just goes to show TNA does have some positives to their legacy, and this show ranks high up as one of them.
Andrew finally says, I used to make my own wrestling montages. The Joe Daniels Styles match was my favorite, done to the tune of 10,000 fists by Disturbed. The match is the best TNA has ever had and one of the best triple threats ever. Also, maybe that's up on YouTube. He actually brings up a question he wants to know. Between Styles, Daniels, and Joe, and Michaels, Triple H, and Benoit, which three-way do you think is better?
Sorry, what was Hunter, Michaels, and Benoit?
Yeah.
And this?
From WrestleMania 20, yeah.
Yeah, there was the WrestleMania 20 match. To be honest, the following month at Backlash, again, they had an even better three-way, I thought, than the WrestleMania match. Those are, you know, kind of one and two of recent three-ways. That I've never been a big three-way fan, but those were the two that come to mind. I mean, I'm partial to this one just because I thought it had more importance because it went in that main event slot, and watching it with 2005 eyes, it was, man, this is something
I don't know if it had more importance. That was the main event in WrestleMania.
But it wasn't as if this was something that was going to be defining a product or something that this company had.
They kind of intended it to.
Well, I mean, both had similar in the fact that Chris Benoit was this guy that was suddenly put into the main event picture, but after he dropped the title, was right back to where he started. And these three as well, you got the sense they were going to be pivotal stars. And realistically, I mean, they would be very much TNA stars, but this wasn't a style that necessarily changed what TNA was or had an influence beyond a number of years when it could have.
But as a pure match, you enjoyed this one more?
I haven't watched the Benoit three-ways since
they
happened.
Yeah, hard to say. They're both very good matches, but, I mean, having just seen this, I feel like this is probably it's hard to say. They're both very different circumstances, and I think they're both very good in their own right.
So we're not answering your question.
No.
What we're saying.
What do you rate this show?
You know, I give this show an 8 out of 10. Mm-hmm. It felt like a product that, yeah, there was good, there was bad to it. But as a show, I enjoyed it. It went by pretty quickly. Main event off the charts. And I really enjoyed that Sabu Abyss match. And
I think that's
saying something, because I typically hate those matches.
I enjoyed that match, obviously the main event. And I thought Aries and Strong was a very pleasant 10-minute surprise in the middle of all this.
Yeah,
too.
That kind
of
gets buried on this
show.
So
I'll give it an 8.1 out of 10.
Son of a bitch. All right, next week's show, we don't know what we're doing. So we're going to call the man that's supposed to join us, that I don't know if he will be joining us.
I doubt it. I highly doubt he'll join us next week. I think he'll be very busy this week.
I'm gonna see if he will.
No, don't. I wouldn't even make
Well, he had already said he would. He's not going to answer.
No.
Okay, he's not coming. So next week's show,
and for good reason, the man just had a kid. So,
yes, dude, I'm not putting any guilt on him.
Let's not bother him. Let's leave him to his family and give him some private time.
All right. Well, I don't mind being the number two priority for this week for him, as long as we are kind of
drop everything you're doing. Watch this wrestling show. All right. What do you want to do next week?
Well, next week we are going to take a look back at. You know, I was searching for a show last week and came across this that I think would actually – it kind of – it's this exact same time period, and it was the WWE's first show back on the USA Network when they moved Raw back. It was October the 3rd of 2005, so 2 days after TNA debuted on Spike,
and was also going head-to-head with a live UFC show. This was the night when Vince wanted to scoop up Mike Goldberg from the UFC and move him over. Do you want to go watch the Raw homecoming show?
Okay.
This does also feature the final Kurt Angle Shawn Michaels singles match.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yes.
Sure.
So we will go back and we will review a 3-hour episode of Raw.
That was 3 hours?
It was
shit.
It was back when a 3-hour Raw was, holy Christ, that's a long show.
I guess I can't say no. Now
we're all tired. We're too committed at this point. We've already discussed
it. Is that on the network? It
is on Daily Motion.
Okay,
so we will post a link to it so everyone can watch it. Raw Homecoming featuring Kevin Von Erich in Dallas, and they brought back every legend under the sun for this particular show.
Man, I can't believe that was like 10 years ago.
It was 10 years ago.
Wow,
a lot going on in the world of Spike TV and the USA Network as they were going to battle on this particular night. So that's what we will review next week. And to finish things off, I think it's only appropriate that we have Gretchen Wilson take us out to put a cap on Unbreakable 2005.
This was, I'd say, probably the definitive podcast on Unbreakable, TNA Unbreakable. I don't know how many two-hour podcasts there have been covering this one show.
We had all angles. Jeremy Borash from that night.
Yeah.
Nate Milton himself.
Kelly Gruber.
Kelly Gruber autographed cards.
Yeah.
Chatted about Limetown.
It's Gretchen Wilson.
I feel like we started the show hours and hours ago, and we kind of did.
We kind of did.
This has been a lengthy fucking show.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Wade doesn't want to talk with me for at least another week.
No.
So we're going to sign off, and Gretchen Wilson is going to take us out because this podcast was all jacked up.
Make this be something different, you have to make it be something different. And you have to kind of be an alternative. If I created just kind of Raw light and SmackDown light, then it's always just going to be less than. I wanted to create an environment that people could do everything that the WWE did in a different way, so that when you came up, there was a slight style difference, but everything else was exactly the same. You were just in a bigger building with more people. And then we surpassed that, too, in a way. So, yeah, I mean, I wanted it to be an alternative because there already was this. I wanted it to be different. I wanted it to be an alternative. And not because I think one is wrong or right. You know, we talked earlier about, Finn talked about getting all these different opinions. You ask 100 people about this business, you'll get 100 different answers. A lot of times we'll say there's not one right and there's not one wrong. It's variations of right. It's chocolate and vanilla, you know. It's really that. It's just preferences, and then you go down that line. But if we already had a ton of vanilla, I wanted to make chocolate.